You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Takes on the World News.
This is Jeff Blankford with Takes on the World. While Donald Trump was still huffing and puffing last weekend about the Seattle judge who declared unconstitutional his executive order banning immigrants from seven Muslim countries from entering the United States, millions watching the Super Bowl who tuned in earlier saw a very different pre-recorded version of our newly elected president. Being interviewed by Fox News' Bill Riley, Trump was challenged once again for his past comments praising Russian President Vladimir Putin. "Do you respect Putin?" O'Reilly asked him. And when Trump answered in the affirmative, O'Reilly wanted to know why. "Well," responded Trump, "I respect a lot of people, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him. He's a leader of his country. I say it's better to get along with Russia than not. And if Russia helps us in the fight against ISIS, which is a major fight, that's a good thing. Will I get along with him?" "But he's a killer, though. Putin's a killer," O'Reilly snapped back. "There are a lot of killers," said Trump. "We've got a lot of killers. What do you think, our country is so innocent?" Well, that exchange led the entire editorial board of the New York Times to answer the call to the colors, the very same institution that devoted its pages 14 years ago to backing up the lies of President George W. Bush about Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Quote, "The bromance between President Trump and Vladimir Putin of Russia, long a source of puzzlement and alarm in the West, has gotten even more disturbing," so began the editorial. "This weekend," it continued, "Mr. Trump dismissed a question about why he respected a killer like Mr. Putin by drawing a moral equivalency between the United States and Russia." End quote. Well, that's a very risky statement for the Times to pose to an intelligent reader. When one considers not only the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis killed by the U.S. military in Iraq since 2003 and the effective destruction of that country as well as Libya, and the attack and add on to that Washington's role in creating ISIS and the jihadists who in the name of Islam have been terrorizing the entire region and much of Africa, there is hardly a single country over which the United States can claim moral superiority. But the New York Times obviously cannot see that. Quote, the Times again, "Asserting the moral and political superiority of the United States over Russia has not traditionally been a difficult maneuver for American presidents," the Times tells us. "But rather than endorsing American exceptionalism," it goes on, "Mr. Trump seems to appreciate Mr. Putin's brutality, which includes bombing civilians in Syria and, his accusers allege, responsibility for a trail of dead political opponents and journalists at home, and suggested America acts the same way." End quote. What world is the New York Times editorial board living in that it can employ the jingoistic term American exceptionalism? It obviously is not one in which others, in the Times' opinion, have the right to judge our actions or bring our war criminals before an international court of law. But it gets worse, incredibly worse, for a newspaper considered to be America's quote-unquote paper of record and leading opinion purveyor for the liberal intelligentsia. Goes on. "There's no doubt the United States has made terrible mistakes," it admits, "like invading Iraq in 2003 and torturing terrorism suspects after September 11th. President Barack Obama," it notes, "often drew fire from Republicans for acknowledging the obvious. There are limits to American power, and sometimes decisions to employ military forces have resulted in," quote-unquote, "unintended consequences," end quote. "American drone strikes against extremists in Afghanistan and Pakistan, for instance, have sometimes killed civilians," end quote. Wrong. Those war crimes, a term the Times refrains from using when the killers are Americans, were no more unintended consequences than were the deaths of the hundreds of thousands of Japanese in the Air Force's firebombing of Tokyo and the atomic bombs it dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or like the Germans who perished under U.S. bombs in Dresden, Hamburg, and Cologne, like the North Vietnamese in Hanoi, civilians were the targets. But, contends the New York Times editorial, "no American president has done what Mr. Putin has done in silencing nearly all independent media, crushing dissent, snuffing out Russia's once incipient democracy, invading Ukraine, interfering in the American election, apparently on Mr. Trump's behalf, and trying to destabilize Europe. At least in recent decades," it goes on, "American presidents who took military action have been driven by the desire to promote freedom and democracy, sometimes with extraordinary results, as when Germany and Japan evolved after World War II from vanquished enemies into trusted, prosperous allies." End quote. Okay, we'll stop there and examine what the Times is telling us and then move on. I'm not an expert on the internal workings of Russia, but even the Times occasionally reports on its dissenters. Having lived, however, through the period of Joe McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee's blacklist and witch hunts, and Harry Truman's launching of the loyalty oaths that became required of all public officials, including school teachers, this country is in no position to lecture any other regarding civil liberties. Moreover, no matter how many Times says it is so, Russia did not invade Ukraine, and there is yet to be produced for the public record a shred of evidence that Russia interfered in our presidential elections. Moreover, I will argue that this charge has been part of a cover-up to make people forget that there was overwhelming evidence that the only interference in the election came from the Democratic National Committee in the successful efforts to sabotage the campaign of Bernie Sanders, who, as polls showed at the time, had a better chance of defeating Trump in November than did Clinton. Listeners should ask themselves and their friends why that is no longer being talked or written about. The Times further insults the intelligence of his readers by stating that, quote, at least in recent decades, American presidents who took military action have been driven by the desire to promote freedom and democracy, end quote. Who will own up to writing such garbage? Does promoting freedom and democracy explain why not only does the U.S. spend more money on weapons of war than the next 10 countries with the highest military budgets combined, but also is the planet's largest weapons seller? Why we have over 1,000 military bases in over 130 countries, Russia has one in Syria. As Martin Luther King told those assembled in New York's Riverside Church on April 7, 1967, a year to the day before his assassination, when he broke his agreement with Lyndon Johnson not to speak out against the Vietnam War, King said, the United States, quote, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, end quote. What he said was not only true that day, it has been true every day since. While we are looking back at our history, I felt we should remember John Yoo, now a professor at UC Berkeley, but quite a controversial figure under Bush-Cheney administration. Weighing in Monday in an op-ed in What Else? The New York Times, targeting Trump and wrapping himself in the wisdom of Alexander Hamilton, Yoo bragged, quote, as an official in the Justice Department, I followed in Hamilton's footsteps, advising that President George W. Bush could take vigorous, perhaps extreme measures to protect the nation after the September 11th attacks, including invading Afghanistan, opening the Guantanamo Detention Center, and conducting military trials and enhanced interrogation of terrorist leaders. In other words, he is still justifying torture, and that is quite all right, evidently, with the Times opinion page editor. Likewise, you went on, I supported President Barack Obama when he drew on this source of constitutional power for drone attacks and foreign electronic surveillance. But even I have grave concerns about Mr. Trump's use of presidential power, end quote. Well, coming from John Yoo, that's not much of a recommendation. I'm not going to list his concerns, but you can find those by going online. But for those who with legitimate complaints about the actions and statements of President Trump, and there are many, having John Yoo as an ally is not something you should feel comfortable about. One thing the New York Times has not written about is the growing bromance between Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which has been publicized in the Israeli press but censored by the U.S. media, no doubt because the American public would have as hard a time understanding how the leader of our great Middle Eastern ally is in bed politically with America's number one enemy, as those who demonize Putin while worshiping Netanyahu would have explaining it. Well, let's give credit where credit is due. Netanyahu, or more precisely, the organizations of the Israel lobby that act in his and Israel's behalf, don't want Americans to know about the Netanyahu-Putin bromance, and so the U.S. media doesn't tell them. On February 15th, a week from today, Trump is scheduled to get together with Netanyahu for their first meeting since he won the White House, a victory that Netanyahu eagerly applauded. Trump, like other presidential candidates before him, promised to move the U.S. embassy from Jerusalem, which Israel alone considers its capital. But unlike his predecessors, who for political reasons backed off, he seems likely to do it, although not as quickly as anticipated. From all the preliminaries, including the appointment of his lawyer David Friedman, a supporter and funder of the settlers who maintains a home in Jerusalem, to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel, and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, an Orthodox Jew and also a funder of the settlers and other hardline Israeli causes, as his emissary to deal with the Palestinians, the path seems to be set for another bromance. Trump, like Putin, already did Netanyahu a favor before he took office by phoning Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, asking him to withdraw the resolution to the UN Security Council condemning Israel's settlements as a violation of international law. The resolution was then picked up by New Zealand and pushed through the Security Council by a 14-0 vote, despite the effort of Russia's UN ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, acting on Putin's orders to get the vote postponed. Oh, you only heard that on this program, the only mention in the U.S. media. Obama's decision to have the U.S. allow the resolution to pass by having its ambassador, Samantha Power, abstain rather than vetoing it, brought the wrath of the Israeli-occupied Congress down on his head, and Trump promised nothing would happen like that with him in the White House. Not only do I see another bromance in Trump's future, but throw in Putin, and now we see the world's strangest menage a trois. Early statements by Trump and his criticism of Obama were taken by the ultra-right that dominates the Israeli Knesset as a green light to further expand Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Thus, on Monday, as the Times of Israel reported, and quote, following months of coalition wrangling, damning criticism from internal and international opposition, and bleak warnings from legal experts, by a 60-52 vote, Israel legalized all West Bank outposts with sweeping legislation that aims to prevent future demolitions of settler homes built on private Palestinian land, end quote. The Palestinian land, of course, had been stolen, as was most of what was once Palestine going back to 1948. In a late-night session, the Times of Israel noted, the Knesset passed the final readings of the controversial so-called regulation bill, which paves the way for Israel to recognize some 4,000 illegally built settler homes. The legislation still must be approved by Israel's Supreme Court. All opposition Knesset members present voted against the bill, with veteran Likud member Benny Begin the only coalition member to oppose the measure. Begin is the son of the late former Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, who is a leading proponent of building Jewish settlements. Before the founding of the state, the senior Begin headed the Zionist terrorist group, Irgun, which was responsible for the massacre of the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin outside of Jerusalem in April 1948, and the blowing up of the King David Hotel, which housed the British headquarters in Jerusalem 2 years earlier. Last week, according to Haaretz, Palestinian Authority officials were warned by the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, now operating at Trump's orders, that if they appealed to the International Criminal Court in The Hague about new settlements that had been approved by the Israeli government, they will lose U.S. funding. The warning comes after the Israeli government, in another sign of confidence in Trump, approved 3,000 new residences on the disappearing Palestinian West Bank. Netanyahu announced that a new colony will be established there as well. Perhaps it will have its own Trump Tower.
طفلة تنتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with a report from the Electronic Intifada, written by Charlotte Silver. It involves yet another attempt on the part of Palestinian lawyers to challenge the Israeli theft of land that has become the hallmark of the Israeli occupation. Such lawsuits have been overwhelmingly unsuccessful in the biased Israeli courts, but continue to be brought by Palestinian lawyers as acts of resistance. Palestinians will continue to challenge home demolitions, wall expansion, land theft, and in fact every vestige of occupation with all the tools available to them, including the courts. But there seems to be some optimism that this line of legal challenge might be successful. Charlotte Silver writes, "A lawsuit filed with Israel's High Court might open a new legal course for scores of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank who have had their land seized by the military over the last 50 years. Though Israel's High Court has a history of ruling favorably on expanding settlements, Dror Etkes, a longtime Israeli settlement researcher, promises the new lawsuit is the first of its kind that could trigger dozens more like it. When Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, its military proceeded to seize huge swaths of land under various pretexts. By 1987, the military had seized 40% of the land in the West Bank, along with its major water resources. To confiscate such vast tracts of Palestinian farmland, Israel frequently invoked temporary military or security reasons. The Hague Regulations, the set of international laws that pertain to war and occupation, allow an occupying power to take temporary possession of land for military use. And once taken, access to the land was blocked to its Palestinian owners. How that land was ultimately used varied, but it frequently passed through the military's hands and became an Israeli civilian settlement. That is what happened just outside Hebron, where Israel founded Kiryat Arba, one of its first settlements in the West Bank, on a military base in 1968, and further north in Al-Baray and Dura al-Kar, where the military seized Palestinian land for military purposes, only to use it to establish the Bet El settlement. And that is the case of Aqraba, a village in the north of the occupied West Bank near Nablus. Now the village is suing the Israeli state in what some hope will be a precedent-setting lawsuit. In 1972, Israel expropriated about 90% of Aqraba's farmland, or 50 square miles, said Etkes, who has researched the history of the village. The huge expropriation left dozens of families who once cultivated the Fair Valley with no source of livelihoods. Aerial photographs taken on the eve of the seizure show the area was filled with cultivated plots of land. Focusing on just one parcel of the seized land, about 790 acres, Etkes has helped organize the lawsuit against the Israeli state, settlers, and quarry companies to give the land back to the original owners. This land was originally taken under the auspices of temporary military necessity, Etkes said, but it eventually formed the cornerstone of the civilian settlement of Gittit. The petition, filed on behalf of the Aqraba municipality and the families of the original owners of the land in October last year, calls on the Israeli government to cancel the seizure order made in 1972, Etkes said, because there is no longer any security or military grounds to justify the confiscation. As of now, the government has not fully replied to the petition. They are biding their time, Etkus told the Electronic Intifada. They understand this could be the beginning of other similar claims. They, the Israeli military, could find themselves under a flood of similar petitions. In the first 12 years of the occupation, Israel seized about 12,000 acres for temporary military use. Nearly a half century later, the essential and urgent military needs for the land once argued by Israel have been clearly exposed as a means to settle Jews in the occupied territories. The Geneva Conventions, which regulate the humanitarian conduct and obligations in conflict, prohibit an occupying power from transferring its civilian population to the occupied territory. According to Etkus, after 1975, settlers took over cultivating the land that once belonged to Palestinian families. At the outbreak of the Palestinian uprising in 2000, the land fell into disuse before settlers began subletting it to Palestinians. Etkus noted the irony in Palestinians paying settlers to access their historic land. Over time, Etkus said, large-scale farms run by settlers have pushed out smaller Palestinian farms, and today, Akraba's land is mostly cultivated by a few Israeli settler operations. In the process of researching how the land has been used, Etkus discovered that a portion of the 3,200 dunam parcel was given over to open an Israeli quarry in 2001. It operated for just a few months and was shut down by 2002. You can see a scar in the mountain today, Etkus said, but no operation. The Shafir Corporation plans to resume mining on the location, as was revealed in the course of the petition. The village's petition argues that this violates the state's promise that it would not open any new Israeli quarries in the West Bank per the High Court recommendation in 2011. At the time of the ruling, there were some 10 Israeli quarries operating in the West Bank. These deliver almost all their material over the 1949 armistice line separating the occupied West Bank from present-day Israel, violating the international laws of occupation and human rights law. The High Court ruled that those quarries may still operate, stating Israel had the right to utilize natural resources in a reasonable manner, but recommended no new sites be opened. The Shafir Company and the Civil Administration, Israel's occupying authority, say the 2011 ruling does not apply to the quarry in Akraba because it was licensed before the ruling. Furthermore, Shafir claims it intends to sell most of what is mined there to Palestinians, according to Etkus. Last year, Human Rights Watch reported that Israeli quarries sell 94% of the materials they produce to Israel or Israeli settlements and pay fees to settlement municipalities and the civil administration, which cannot be said to benefit the Palestinian people. The Hague regulations prohibit an occupying power from using the resources of the occupied territory for domestic purposes. The Akraba petition is not the first time Israel's High Court will review the military's security rationalization for settlements in the occupied territories. Over the decades, the High Court has avoided issuing rulings that have far-reaching implications for the government's settler colonial project in the West Bank, in effect, greenlighting it. In 1979, for example, the High Court argued with the military that a civilian settlement, that is Beit El, built on land requisitioned for military needs, can in fact serve a military purpose. However, shortly after, the court mitigated this ruling with a new decision on the Elon Moray settlement. In this case, the military had tried to argue the Elon Moray settlement served a military purpose after settlers had established an unauthorized colony on private Palestinian land. The High Court ruled this settlement did not clearly serve military purposes, leading the Israeli government to focus on seizing and declaring Palestinian land as state land for its settlements. The High Court has maintained that its decisions will be made on a case-by-case basis. This case will be important in terms of the legal strategy which we will be able to use in the coming years regarding similar cases, said Etkes, who expects a reply from the government before the next court session, scheduled for March. Now, that is a report written by Charlotte Silver, associate editor of the Electronic Intifada. But now a new wrinkle that could upset the optimism that this lawsuit has engendered. Just this past Monday, February 6th, the Knesset passed a bold new bill that would allow for land confiscation that heretofore was illegal to now be legal. Exactly how this new law will affect the current litigation is unclear, but it certainly adds a new dimension to the conflict. Freelance journalist Shireen Kalel, who writes out of Palestine, Jordan, and Israel, wrote the following article following the passage of the new law. The Israeli Knesset on Monday passed a controversial new bill that allows the Israeli government to expropriate private Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, making more than a dozen Israeli settlements legal under Israeli law. The unprecedented bill passed late Monday night with 60 votes in favor to 52 against, according to Palestinian government news agency WAFA. The legislation, referred to as the Regularization Bill, legalizes more than 4,000 settler outpost units under Israeli law and has been dubbed the first step toward de facto annexation. It is the first time in history that the Knesset has imposed Israeli civil law in the occupied West Bank, which is under Israeli military and civilian rule. The sponsors of the bill said the law was an historic step toward the completion of a process that we plan to lead. The application of full Israeli sovereignty on all of the cities and communities in Judea and Samaria, according to the Jerusalem Post. Following the bill's passing, Education Minister Naftali Bennett tweeted one word, revolution. The law is in direct contravention with international law, which deems all Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem illegal. Following the vote, international and local human rights groups strongly condemned the new legislation. Meanwhile, the European Union canceled a summit between Israel and the European Union scheduled for February 28th, according to the Israeli daily Haaretz. The daily reported that France, Sweden, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Finland publicly expressed their reservations regarding the summit, and that some countries argued that holding a meeting at this time would be akin to rewarding Israel for its bad conduct. B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights NGO, called the bill a slap in the face of the international community. The Knesset today proved yet again that Israel has no intention of ending its control over the Palestinians or its theft of their land. Lending a semblance of legality to this ongoing act of plunder is a disgrace for the state and its legislature, the group said in a statement. Omar Shakir, Israel and Palestine country director at Human Rights Watch, said the legislation reflects Israel's manifest disregard of international law. The bill further entrenches the current reality in the West Bank of de facto permanent occupation, where Israeli settlers and Palestinians living in the same territory are subject to separate and unequal systems of laws, rules, and services, Shakir said. Israeli officials driving settlement policy should know that the Trump administration cannot shield them from the scrutiny of the International Criminal Court, where the prosecutor continues to examine unlawful Israeli settlement activity. On Monday, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, said passing such a law would amount to a declaration of war. After the vote, PLO Executive Committee member Dr. Hanan Ashrari expressed concern for what the law would mean for future land annexation by Israel. Such a law signals the final annexation of the West Bank. Not only does it attempt to retroactively legalize the settlements and outposts built on Palestinian private property, it also gives clear license to the settlers to embark on a land grab in the occupied West Bank with impunity, she said. Israel is authorizing the unlawful act of land theft and its illegal settlement activities, which are a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court and an egregious violation of international law and conventions, she said. All settlements are illegal, whether on private property or on state land that belongs to the Palestinian collective as a whole. This also proves beyond doubt that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist racist coalition government are deliberately breaking the law and destroying the very foundations of the two-state solution and the chances for peace and stability. Xavier Abu Eid, a spokesperson for the PLO's Negotiation Affairs Department, said the law essentially legalized theft of Palestinian land, adding that the legislation negates peace and the possibility of a two-state solution. Looting is illegal, said Abu Eid. All Israeli settlements in occupied Palestine are illegal and a war crime, regardless of any law passed by the Israeli parliament or any decision taken by an Israeli judge. Peace Now, an Israeli NGO aimed at promoting a two-state solution, strongly condemned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for being willing to compromise the future of both Israelis and Palestinians in order to satisfy a small group of extreme settlers for the sake of his own political survival, and called on the Israeli Supreme Court to overturn the legislation. By passing this law, Netanyahu makes theft an official Israeli policy and stains the Israeli law books. By giving a green light to settlers to build illegally on private Palestinian land, the legalization law is another step towards annexation and away from a two-state solution. In light of this madness, we must act as the responsible adults and turn to the Supreme Court in order to strike down this dangerous law. That was an article written by freelance journalist Shireen Kalel. And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is a conversation with a remarkable journalist, Rimara Haas, who writes for the Israeli newspaper Aretz. The conversation is with Chris Hedges, a journalist who has written for the New York Times and many other publications, and takes place on his RT television news program, On Contact.
On Contact. Welcome to On Contact. Today we're going to be speaking with the courageous Israeli journalist, Amir Haas.
Look, there are things that Netanyahu, of course, is different than others. I think he and the generation of today's rulers have no shame.
Ankan, neoliberalism, patriotism. Truth is not a social media, class war, corporate coup d'etat, utopian ideology of neoliberalism revolts unmasked. Israel has been poisoned by the psychosis of permanent war. It has been morally bankrupted by the sanctification of victimhood, which it uses to justify an occupation that rivals the brutality and racism of apartheid South Africa. Its democracy, which was always exclusively for Jews, has been hijacked by extremists who are pushing the country toward a form of fascism. Many of Israel's most enlightened and educated citizens, 1 million of them, have left the country. Its most courageous human rights campaigners, intellectuals and journalists, Israeli and Palestinian, are subject to constant state surveillance, arbitrary arrests, and government-run smear campaigns. Its educational system, starting in primary school, has become an indoctrination machine for the military and the growing intolerance, racism, and fanaticism, which always existed on the fringes of Israeli society, have moved into the political mainstream. Anya Parampil examines the public manifestations of racism that now characterize Israeli society.
In 1948, the United Nations partitioned historic Palestine into two states, an Arab state and a Jewish state known as Israel. Israel was founded by members of the Zionist movement who aimed to create an exclusively Jewish state in the majority Arab Palestine. And following its declaration of independence on May 15, 1948, an estimated 750,000 indigenous Palestinians were expelled from their homes by Zionist militias and made refugees. The day has become known as the Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe to the Palestinian people. In the aftermath of the Nakba, Israel passed two critical laws, the Absentee Property Act and the Infiltration Prevention Act. As part of the Zionist effort to preserve Israel's ethnic purity, the laws forbade the presence of Palestinian refugees from Israel and gave the government power to seize homes in Jerusalem, kicking families out. The goal of Israel from now on would be to keep the most amount of Jews on the most amount of land and the most amount of Palestinians on the least amount of land possible. Thanks to several military offensives and illegal Jewish settlement expansion, over the decades, the borders once drawn for Israel have disappeared, along with Palestinian-controlled land. Palestinians continuously resist this expansion, most notably during the First and Second Intifadas, or uprisings, the second of which ended in 2005 and turned violent as the occupation deepened and the Israeli military's tactics hardened. Under the current right-wing Likud party headed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the country has passed a slew of anti-democratic laws, including banning Nakba demonstrations, criminalizing the boycott of products from illegal settlements, and the creation of community acceptance laws, which actually allow neighborhoods to deny minorities residency. Israeli police are now also allowed to use sniper fire on child stone throwers. But considering the words of high-level Israeli politicians, perhaps these laws aren't so surprising. For example, during Israel's 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip in 2014, Education Minister Naftali Bennett responded to news of four Palestinian children blown up on the beach by the Israeli military by accusing them of, quote, self-genocide. Justice Minister Eilat Shaked has referred to all Palestinians as, quote, the enemy, and said in a Facebook post Palestinian mothers should be killed to prevent them from, quote, giving birth to little snakes. And Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman declared last year that Palestinians disloyal to Israel should have their heads cut off. Perhaps the current state of Israel is best summed up in the words of former president of the Supreme Court, Aharon Barak. Israel is different from other countries. It's not only a democratic state, but also a Jewish state.
There are few Israeli journalists who have the courage and integrity of Amir Ahas. She is the only Israeli journalist who has lived for prolonged periods of time and continues to live in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She is angered because of her uncompromising honesty, the Palestinian and Israeli leadership. The Israeli government has accused her of incitement to violence and had her arrested in 2009 after living in Gaza for several months for violating a law which forbids residence in an enemy state. Haas is the author of Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Days and Nights in a Land Under Siege. Please join me in conversation with one of the most intrepid and fearless reporters in Israel. Thank you, Amira.
Thank you, please.
Your awakening to the Palestinian condition, how did that happen?
Oh, that was quite early, I guess, because I was a red-diapered baby. So it's not...
Red-diaper yeah. baby?
My parents were in the Communist Party and Holocaust survivors, so it came very early. I think we won't start to go back that
but
far.
But it's interesting because if you, like with Gideon Levy, another fine reporter, it really took his traveling within the occupied territories to change his understanding of what the occupation meant.
Yeah, I'm not that lucky, you know, like I was... I was born understanding that, almost born understanding, because I lived in I was part of a family that was, as I said, in the Communist Party, where there were Palestinian members, and we were at odds with the society around us. My father was arrested for several times while I was a child, and my mother was arrested. The police came to arrest my mother because she distributed leaflets against Ben-Gurion. So it was not...
Ben-Gurion being the founding...
First prime minister. So it's for me, I must say that I'm really not quite conservative in that sense.
Well, you were fortunate in your parents, let's put it that way.
Yes, I guess. I mean, I don't deplore having been, conservative in this way.
I was raised in the same household. It saved me a lot of time. I just want to look at, when I lived for 7 years in the Middle East, two of those years in Israel. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. You have that first generation, Ben-Gurion being an example, but Abba Eban. Rabin came out of that. Teddy Kollek, the former mayor of Jerusalem. Many of these people born, and you're not Rabin, but many of these people born in Europe, multilingual, highly educated. And the question was, how do you devolve to a Bibi Netanyahu or an Avigdor Lieberman? Or has the Zionist project always remained the same, hidden behind a different veneer?
Look, there are things that Netanyahu, of course, is different than others. I think he and the generation of today's rulers have no shame. In the times of Abba Eban, even Ben-Gurion, they were hiding much.
Right.
They were not disclosing all what they were doing because still they were loyal to, or at least nominally, they were loyal to a set of values that they knew that they were violating in Israeli policies. So that's why they invented, if we make fast forward, that's why they invented with the occupation this notion of enlightened occupation. There is no enlightened occupation.
Well, they also carried out the brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing,
of
raising
course,
up, 48, in 48, which is, let's face it, far worse than anything even Bibi Netanyahu has done.
Sure. Only that, let's say, 48 still, I think, if you look historically...
This is the founding of the state of Israel.
Yeah, it's 3 years after the end of the Second World War. It's, Zionism is seen, was until then not so much adopted by the majority of Jews. And all of a sudden, it was adopted by the major, by more Jews only when Hitler actually succeeded in eliminating a great part of the Jewish people in Europe. So the circumstances, historical circumstances, were slightly different, or not slightly different. Europe had 12 million refugees. So it was not, we're not talking about Europe that was a benign place, a great place to live. It just emerged from one of the lowest periods of time in its history. So, and there was war. I mean, you can find ways to explain it or to describe it. While 67, actually Israel established in 67 that it is a colonial state.
Well, this is when it took control of
Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Right.
Yes, yeah, in the
Well, you know, that you take that great Israeli moral philosopher, yes, who saw what everything was, but he would mark the occupation of 67 as really the end, unless Israel relinquishes as the kind of end of Israel as a democratic or an open society. And he has been proven right.
Yes, and some would say, okay, also before, Israel was democratic only because it got rid of the majority of Palestinians.
It was only democratic for Jews.
Yes, and then
always.
But you know, the thing is that if there is a chance to change, what are the chances? What are the opportunities we give ourselves to change?
Right.
And I think that the point where Israel showed that it does not change and that it is a colonial enterprise because it has so decided was with the Oslo Agreement.
Huh.
Because the Oslo in the 90s, the Oslo Agreement gave Israel a chance to cut loose from its colonialistic characteristics.
Right. Do you think that, and because some people, Miko Peled and others, argue that Oslo was just another trick.
It was. That's exactly, but not on the part of the Palestinians.
No, on the part of...
So on the part of Israel. So when the whole world is expecting Israel, you know, now you have South Africa, it's over, and you have the end of the Cold War, it's with the collapse of the Soviet system. So there was an expectation of a change also here.
On the part of the outside world, but not on the part of the Israeli leadership.
So what Israel did is just use it in all the tricks possible to do just the opposite.
Right.
And we are talking, you know, people said Palestinians, the great majority of Palestinians, they said, okay, we give you a chance. Actually, they actually gave Israel a present. They gave Israeli society a present. Acknowledging that there was something, okay, that 48 was ethnic cleansing, as you said, but it was also the historiography of a persecuted people that found refuge in this country. You know, I'm sure that without Hitler and without the Holocaust, Israel would not have existed, or Zionism would not have succeeded the way it did.
Right.
But this is... So Palestinians actually came and told the Israelis, we acknowledge your being here, you being a society here. And then what Israel did is just the opposite, just rejected this very generous offer.
We're going to get back to that after this break.
On Contact.
Welcome back to On Contact. We're here with the Israeli journalist Amira Haas. So Amira, we spoke before the break a little bit about Oslo, 2,000-page document. But in brief, within that document, would you argue, because Israel retained control of the borders and essentially had a stranglehold on the economy, it was just a more sophisticated form of the occupation, or was there things in it that were more insidious than that?
Look, the main thing is that there is no mention of the goal of this so-called peace process.
Right.
So it doesn't state that the goal is two states.
Right.
So it is gradual. Okay, let's agree that you can withdraw gradually, but if you don't have a goal, what's gradual about it? Where to?
Right.
Then, of course, Israel maintained its control over the land, and it was supposed to be temporary until 99, and we are in 2016. And Israel has managed, from before Oslo, from 91 actually, to carve out the Palestinian territory, the would-be Palestinian state.
Well, they're taking more and more land.
Yes, and to create enclaves. So you have actually right. Palestinian reservations.
Right.
Gaza is the model, and then there is replicas in the West
right.
Bank,
kind of
which is in front.
We should explain yeah. that what they've done, and I saw it on a UN map that
yeah.
a UN official gave me, is if you look at a map of the West Bank, It you're correct that it's kind of pod-like areas when you count the settlements, the ring
the
roads.
Area which Israel controls is 62% of the West Bank, and in between you have islands
right.
of Palestinian semi-sovereignty.
And let's touch on water yeah. here because it's an issue that's often not discussed, but it's crucial.
Yeah.
Israel, which you have pointed out, they cannot justify in the name of national security, has seized the aquifers.
Yeah, they use and they impose quota on the Palestinians. They, according to the agreement, about 80% of the aquifers in the West Bank, the water, is used by Israel, and 20% is for Palestinians, which is an outrage.
And you get whole,
in Gaza,
in refugee camps, you get into houses where they don't have potable water coming out of the taps. They can't drink the water.
Not only there, you know, like refugee camps are sometimes are better off because they are being paid by others and they don't have to pay. No, you have in whole communities like in Hebron, all the summer they are in a special regime where they get water only once a week or once a month. Yes. And Gaza, which is even a worse crime, Gaza is taken as a should be self-sufficient with the water it has on its aquifer. So in 1948, before the plight and before it was filled with refugees, there were about 80,000 or 100,000 people, and the aquifer they used from the water of the aquifer, which was about 170, if I'm correct, million cubic meter, and it's the same amount today when you have almost 2 million people. So they are supposed to be to use the same water as if they were an island separated from the rest of the country. So instead of having an agreement where Palestinians can, or when Israel, instead of the water that it steals in the West Bank, gives direct to Gaza, then they are over pumping, and the 95% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable. They have to purify everything as if, you know, like in the worst places in the third world.
Let's talk about, because we're filming this in New York, you've been teaching at NYU, you're about to go back to Ramallah, which is in the West Bank, where you have been living and reporting. How, to outsiders, do you describe not only the occupation, but the evolution of the occupation in the years that you've been covering it?
The main thing is indeed this living in enclaves, that your psyche is getting used to living in enclaves, that there is semi or false or fake or quasi-sovereignty, sense of quasi-sovereignty within the enclaves under Palestinian policing power.
What would you say? There's roughly about a half dozen in the West Bank. Would we call them these kind of Bantustans?
Let me say it's about seven. I mean, you have Gaza. I mean, you have Jenin, you have Nablus, you have Tulkarem, you have Qalqilya, you have Ramallah, you have Hebron, you have Bethlehem.
And
so
we should be clear
seven.
That one
yeah.
of the things the Israelis do is they make it very difficult to travel between these enclaves.
It's different. I mean, with one of the successes of the World Bank and USAID or whatever was to guarantee that there is a contiguity. There is transportational contiguity. So you can, theoretically, you can go from Jenin and you can reach Ramallah, and you don't go through too many Israeli checkpoints. But at any moment, Israel can close the roads. At any moment, you can run into an Israeli soldier.
And don't they
soldier.
Inhibit the trafficking of produce between?
Yes, but it's not as it used to be 10 years ago. This is not the issue. I mean, the issue is that you need in order to develop, you need the space, you need the land, you need, you said the water, but not just the water. You want to build, for example, land in Ramallah is ridiculously expensive because you cannot build in other places. So people are, so land inside Ramallah became more expensive than New York in some places. Dunam, I don't know how much people pay, maybe it's not more, but more than Tel Aviv. But you live in those enclaves and you feel that you are far, far, 1 kilometer from an Israeli base or 3 kilometers from a settlement. And you get used to it because still it is better than living directly under Israeli occupation.
Well, you have your quisling Palestinian Authority for...
Yes, I use milder word terms. I think it's not... I don't think that they did it from the beginning so consciously as he did. I mean, let's not exaggerate. But subcontractors, yes, you have subcontractors. But also not I mean, it's not just the subcontractors, but also there is a class in Palestinian society that right now they do not see any other horizon.
Right.
So they get used to this internal.
Is the Israeli tactic to reduce Palestinians to such a draconian subsistence level that all of their energy goes into just survival within these enclaves? Is that kind of the goal?
It might be true to say about Gaza, but about the West Bank, I think it would be wrong to explain it that way. It's not such a low subsistence. I mean, it is. You have a middle class. You have opportunities to make money. You do have a growing Palestinian in certain places, bourgeoisie. You do have it. It's not. I mean, people are not on the verge of poverty, on the verge of starvation or hunger.
As we see in Gaza.
And even in Gaza, okay, this is thanks to the world. Yes,
Gaza.
Yes. And even in Gaza, I mean, you have the whole world paying money, which is hush money, in order not to force Israel to.
Well, let's talk about what this is. What is this done to Israeli society? I mean, when I was in Israel, which was many years ago, you had figures like Meir Kahana, the right-wing Jewish extremist, spewing racist.
He's mainstream now.
Yes, that's exactly the point. He's mainstream now in figures like Avigdor Lieberman, even Netanyahu. What's happened? I mean, to what's happened to Israeli democracy? The Israeli state has been quite harsh with you.
With me?
Sure.
Not compared to what they do
to the Palestinians, but they've...
Yeah, it's... you know, when you said I was arrested, I was detained for a few hours. It's not... still, I say we have democracy for Jews. It is changing, of course, but not that dramatically. Like any society that has privileges, or any group that has privileges, and it's overstepping and you want to preserve your privileges, and those who are underprivileged fight against these privileges, then you have to justify all your ways of controlling and repression by racist theories. I think this is true about many places in the world, if not all, where you have privileges. So you men have privileges, so they will develop ideas about inferiority of women in order to safeguard. And so it is, and the more we have privileges, and the more it is clear that it is at the account of the Palestinians, and the more it is at the account of any prospect for change and fairness, if not justice, in the country, the more Israeli society have to explain it by racist terms and that these are Arabs and they do not deserve it and they don't need it and they are better off with us.
Doesn't this have, I think arguably it does have ramifications internally within Israel. You're seeing, and we'll close with this increasing suppression of Israeli human rights groups, journalists such as yourself, that
sure.
Disease has now come back to
Israel.
Yeah,
this is normal. I mean, in a way, maybe surprisingly late, But yes, they address, look, they address the Israeli human rights organization and anti-occupation organizations, those that focus on the settlements. And the settlements embody this notion of Israeli privileges.
Right.
Of course, in the very fact that you can move there in a and get land for...
And that is the policy, constant building. I mean, the last time I was in East Jerusalem, the first time I was in East Jerusalem was 1988. It doesn't even look like the same city anymore.
Sure, and the West Bank. So like a group such as Ta'ayush is a target of both the government and settlement organizations. Groups such as Breaking the Silence,
right,
which is focusing on the occupation and the settlements. So they are being targeted. Yes, and the Israelis go with it. The general Israeli
right.
public, because they are afraid. The Israeli society, Israel used to be a welfare state. Since the 70s, there was an attack on Israeli welfare state, and with the erosion of the withering away of the Israeli welfare state, there is a substitute, and this is in the occupied territory,
right.
The settlements.
Thank you, Amira. The Israeli religious scholar and moral philosopher Yeshayahu Leibowitz once wrote that religious nationalism is to religion what national socialism was to socialism. Leibowitz, who died in 1994, understood that the blind veneration of the military, especially after the 1967 war, where Israel captured the West Bank and East Jerusalem, was dangerous and would lead to the ultimate destruction of Israeli democracy. He foresaw, as he said, that the Arabs would be the working people, and the Jews, the administrators, inspectors, officials, and police, mainly secret police. He feared that a virulent racism would consume Israeli society. He knew that prolonged occupation of the Palestinians would spawn concentration camps for the occupied, and that, in his words, Israel would not deserve to exist, and it will not be worthwhile to preserve it.
That was a conversation with Ramira Haas and Chris Hedges, originating on the RT television program On Contact. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
Coming up next, Unwelcome Guests.
Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The program this week, I mean to be part of a series to confront the question, what is the economy for? Who was our economic system for? Should it be saved, or is it fundamentally misguided in that it discounts or destroys the things that matter and elevates and values the shallow, the cruel, and the repugnant? The discourse surrounding this question, even by those who mean well, often takes for granted certain criteria that are not defined. For example, we hear in mainstream discussion of concepts like efficiency and productivity, without the speakers adding the important question, from whose perspective is something efficient or productive? What is it productive of? banality, ugly buildings, mind-numbing employment, a poisoned environment, ignorance, poorly made junk, desperation and fear, disrespect and contempt, pettiness and confusion, lies and propaganda? In what way is the system efficient when there are millions of homeless people and millions of empty homes? Why should any human being have to ask permission of another human being to go to the bathroom? This is a situation faced by many people in the jobs they're forced to take, rather than starve. My first official experience in employment at age 16 was working at a business that sold pantyhose through the mail. I was one of a group of people that sat in a large room under the watchful eyes of a supervisor, removing money and order forms from envelopes. We were made to wear a plastic smock over our clothes. We were not permitted to talk. A radio station chosen by some manager played relentlessly. And we were not permitted to visit the bathroom without raising our hands to ask permission. This degrading treatment was no doubt justified in the name of efficiency and profitability. Much has been made of the executive bonuses of Wall Street firms receiving bailouts. But to me, there is a more fundamental question that I have never heard anyone mention in a congressional hearing. The fact that no executive is ever compelled to ask permission to go to the bathroom, nor does anyone in the position to make rules that others are compelled to obey ever subject themselves to the level of degradation they inflict on others. Therefore, on the question of what is efficient, if this were an actual free society, no one would tolerate working under such conditions, because they would not be efficient at providing happiness and self-esteem. If pantyhose or anything else can't be provided without degrading treatment or destroying the environment, then to hell with it. Or as they say, take your jobs and shove them. This system is so ethically and imaginatively bankrupt that people now find themselves in the bizarre position of clamoring to save the very jobs they hate to go to every single day. Any society in which people don't set for themselves the terms of how they work, when they work, and what they work on is not a free society. I submit to you that no person who has not been either brainwashed or coerced would accept this. The religion of the market is as delusional a fundamentalism as any you would care to name. In what efficient system would farmers producing wonderful food be so poor that they qualify for food stamps, while others become insanely rich producing credit default swaps? The economics and politics of food is the subject of the first hour, with a new talk from one of my favorite people, Vandana Shiva. In the second hour, I'm going to play you something very special to me. March 31st is the 9-year anniversary of this show. On the very first broadcast of Unwelcome Guests, I played a radio adaptation done by my friend Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio of a documentary, Who's Counting?, on the work of the feminist economist Marilyn Waring. Her critique of the economic system and the politics that support it is the essence of the vision that motivated me to do this radio show. And the past 9 years has been an effort on my part to present evidence and analysis to buttress the view that the corporate world order not only must end, but can end. I'd been thinking of reprising that piece from my first broadcast, since few people who now listen had ever heard it in those years. Then an amazing thing happened. Mariah, independently from me, updated that very same broadcast for her current offering of TUC Radio. Talk about a message from the universe. So we'll hear that in the second hour. I have a favor to ask of you as well. I'd really like to hear from you with some feedback about the show. 9 years is a very long time to do something, and I don't hear from many people who listen. I would be absolutely delighted if you would email me at unwelcome@radioforall.net. And that's radio, the number 4, A-L-L, dot net. So let's get on with Vandana Shiva. The talk comes to us courtesy of Voices for Global Justice. Mansoor Sabah will give the introduction.
Dr. Vandana Shiva is a renowned physicist, philosopher, ecofeminist, and environmental activist. She specializes in the effects of global trade on agriculture and culture. She's also a key figure in the global solidarity movement known as Alter Globalization. Internationally, Dr. Shiva has advised both governmental and non-governmental organizations on issues such as biodiversity, bioethics, sustainable agriculture, and water supply. Dr. Shiva has written several books, including Water Wars, Stolen Harvest, and her latest, Soil Not War, Environmental Justice in a Time of Climate Crisis. Vandana Shiva gave a lecture on sustainability and the world food crisis at the University of Southern California on March 9, 2008.
Thank you for organizing this event and for inviting me here. In a way, the issues and the themes you've kind of chosen to announce are a synthesis of the work I've been doing at the ecological level for 35 years and in terms of sustainable agriculture for 25 years. Normally, when people think of the world food crisis, they think about the rise in food prices, which, of course, is a huge crisis for those who are denied their right to food, people who are anyway eating half of what they should be eating, and now they eat a quarter. Or the billion people who were already hungry, to that gets added 200 million in the last year alone. In 1 year, 200 million additional people were added. And the projections are that if this level of deprivation continues from 2009 to 2015, between 1.4 to 2.8 million people would die for lack of access to food. Lack of food is not a state of nature. Every species gets food. The microbes in the soil get their food. The birds get their food. The bees used to get food. Poor things are being denied too with the pesticides and the colony collapse disorder. But human beings have managed through a strange kind of intelligence to create a system in which 1 billion people go without food and 2 billion people are cursed with bad food. And the curse of bad food to me is as serious a part of the world food crisis as the denial of the right to food. This morning, they brought me my breakfast, and I couldn't eat the potatoes. They were tasteless. They were pure starch. Now, if you've tasted real potatoes out of your organic farm, and you know there should be a taste in potatoes, pure starch is difficult to swallow. And, you know, they're now breeding potatoes in such a way that the same potato could be used for structures, for making chairs, and for feeding people. Now, can you imagine what a mess that has to be? Because hunger is not a state of nature, hunger is created. Now, the normal narrative of hunger is people in the third world are hungry because either they're lazy or they're stupid or they don't have smart technologies. And somehow, if more chemicals were spread in the world or more fossil fuels were used for agriculture, magically you'd have more food. No. If you have more chemicals in farming, you have more toxics. You don't get more food. If you use more fossil fuels in farming, you get more greenhouse gases. You don't get more food. And I don't know why the basic science of what makes food has increasingly been displaced by a scientific mythology. It parades as science, but it's not science, which has systematically, through the very seeking of increasing food production, actually created more hunger in the world. Agriculture used to be women's domain. Women domesticated species. Women were the leaders of creating agriculture. And to the extent that agriculture and food was in women's hand, you know, you might have had hunger for a short time because there was a war, a bad drought, famine. But the system itself did not generate the scarcity. The conditions and context for scarcity came from somewhere else. Industrial agriculture and globalized agriculture is actually creating scarcity. It's creating food scarcity. And it's creating a deprivation of hunger. And a lot of my work has been addressed to the myth that chemical farming, called the Green Revolution in the Third World, has increased food production, or industrial agriculture is a more productive enterprise than ecological farming. Let me just run through some figures. It takes 10 times more energy in an industrial system to produce a calorie of food. You know, you use 10 calories of energy as input and you get out 1 calorie of food. That's a negative economy. And then if you add to it the fact that, especially in this country, food has been reduced to meat and meat has been reduced to factory farms, you have an additional conversion of 10 times food fed to the cattle as feed gives you 1 unit of food as animal protein. So at every step, we have a decline of a factor of 10. And we call that increasing productivity. There's a very simple definition, those of you who've done anything related to productivity. It's output per unit input. The higher your input, the lower your productivity. Industrial agriculture is, by its very definition and nature, a high input system. And it has grown with the illusion that the more food is being produced, but the reality of it is there are interests who would like to turn agriculture into a consumption of chemicals, a consumption of fossil fuels. It becomes a new market. We used to have chemicals restricted to war. And after the wars were over, those who had got used to selling chemicals worked very hard to find their application in agriculture. Two very good books that show this connection, that agrochemicals, the external inputs in farming, are actually war chemicals. One book written in 1930 by a person who was sent to India as an imperial agriculturist. They didn't have the word agriculturist in those days. They used to call them economic botanists. And he was sent to introduce chemicals into Indian farming and improve Indian agriculture. His name is Sir Albert Howard. He's today known as the father of modern organic farming. And in a book he wrote, which is called The Agricultural Testament, he's written very, very clearly that I arrived in India, found the soils fertile, found no pests in the field. I threw away my spray gun and decided to turn the peasant and the pest into my teachers. Out of it came his learning on organic. Out of his learning on organic, and by the way, his learning on organic was also his wife's learning on organic, because Albert Howard and his wife always worked together. They were a wonderful team in wheat breeding, in organic farming. It's his work that led to the creation of the Rodale Research Institute. The grandfather of the current Rodale met Howard and then started all the experiments that have led to the organic initiatives here. And in UK, the organic movement called the Soil Association. The Soil Association, too, was inspired by Howard's work, which was in turn Howard inspired by the Indian agriculture, inspired by the Indian peasant. I'm not having the Dasani because I took a pledge with my friends in the Coca-Cola movement and never touch it. So. And he says in the book, vested interests that had got used to making profits during the war could not give up their addiction. And then they brought the chemical. Fertilizers came out of the war industry that made explosives, and the chemical pesticides are directly designed to kill people, which is what we saw when in 1984, a pesticide plant in the city of Bhopal leaked in the middle of the night, December, cold night, and 3,000 people were killed instantaneously with the poison that leaked from there. And 30,000 people have died since then. Well, 1984 was really the year that kind of pushed me into looking at something was wrong with agriculture. It was also the year we had huge violence in Punjab. And on the 4th of June, I think it was, the Golden Temple, the most sacred shrine of the Sikhs, was invaded by the Indian army because extremists was hiding in there. But this extremist had been cultivated by the central government, just like Bin Laden was cultivated by the Americans to fight the Soviets. You know, and that was the beginning of the whole creation of the Taliban. Bhindarwale was made to grow in order to counter the Akalis, who are the popular party of Punjab. Punjab is where the Green Revolution was introduced. And the Green Revolution was given a Nobel Peace Prize on the thesis that it would create so much prosperity, everyone would be rich, and no one would ever become a revolutionary. Now, green in 1965 did not mean green as sustainable. Green in 1965, when the Green Revolution was introduced, only meant a color different from red. And red was what was happening in China. And the US was very keen that India should not go the China way. Of course, the interesting thing is, with the kind of development that's happening, larger and larger pockets of India are going the China way, with globalization depriving people of their resources, their rights to land, their rights to livelihood. Anyway, the Green Revolution gets brought to Punjab. In the early stages, it doesn't do too badly because there are huge subsidies. The fertilizers come for as good as free. The pesticide comes for free. The seeds are given. But over time, the fertilizer subsidies get withdrawn and the addiction increases, because these are ecological narcotics. The more urea you apply, the more you must apply. The more pesticides you spray, the more you must spray. And it's wonderful for the industry that sells these. I would say that the agrochemical industry is to the planet what drug traffickers are in society, because they sell toxic, lethal drugs that are killing the land and killing people, and do it through an addiction. And the addiction comes with, the first dose is always for free. Comes with a subsidy. Including seeds. Non-renewable seeds are never introduced in a market phenomena. The first bit, you say, you know, brilliant. But in the first, you give up your new renewable seeds, you've got non-renewable seeds, next year you have to buy. Brilliant mechanisms. And very quickly, before we knew it, at the global level, food that used to be women's expertise has now become controlled by a war industry. A war industry controls our food system. And that war industry then has created all this manufacturing of the chemical sort of delivery through chemicals. DDT is good for you. I don't know how many of you have seen pesticide ads, as if everything in the world is going to devour you. Biodiversity is your enemy. And you've got to kill every bug, you've got to kill every insect, and then you'll be safe. Of course, you're not, because the pesticides themselves are the danger. The state of Punjab, and I wrote a book on this, I did it for the United Nations, it's called The Violence of the Green Revolution. By the end of it, I said, this is not about peace. It's violence to the land, it's violence to people, it's violence to human beings. Now from Punjab, we have a daily train. It's called the cancer train. Half of the people who travel that train are cancer patients who are going to a charitable hospital, because who can afford a cancer treatment? But there's a charitable hospital in Rajasthan to which they go. And this train from Punjab to Bikaner, it's called the cancer train. That's the popular name of the train. Every second person has cancer. And that will be the consequence of pumping poisons on your fields, getting farmers into debt, poisoning your groundwater, because all those poisons eventually end up in your groundwater and every day you're drinking them. And then the food that lands up in the food distribution system is also poison. I remember on one of my trips to Punjab more recently, I passed a farmer, old farmer who was carrying a big pesticide spray can. So I stopped and I looked at the labeling, and nothing in the labeling said that this was poison. In fact, the word given to it in third world countries is medicine in local language. Pesticide is sold as medicine. So I asked this farmer, I said, did he know what he was carrying and what he was spraying? And he said, yeah, medicine. So I told him what it was, and it was the same carbaryl pesticide that had leaked in Bhopal. And I told him what it does. And this old man said, oh, now I understand why I get dizzy when I spray. But the second sentence was even more touching. And now I understand why the mango trees in our villages have stopped giving fruit, because the pollinators have all been killed. And now there's no mango flowering. The collapse and disappearance of the bees has become a very big subject now, but it begins with the poisons in our farming systems. And now the poison story is kind of getting to a deeper level. And that deeper level is the fact that where is the war industry and the chemical industry earlier used to spray poisons from the outside, now it is putting poisons inside plants. And this is what genetic engineering does. Again, just like for the Green Revolution, the story was more food, less hunger. In the case of genetic engineering, the story is more food. Way out of hunger is genetically engineered crops. You know, every article in any popular media will tell you that. You need genetic engineering in order to feed the world. Well, in the 20 years of commercialization, you have only two kinds of traits that have been evolved through genetic engineering. One is a trait of putting a gene into the plant that makes the plant resistant to that company's herbicide. So now the company can sell more herbicide, and the plants will survive the contamination of herbicide, and the farmer will have to buy both the herbicide and the seed from the same company. They even have contracts in which you can't buy your chemicals from any other company. And of course, a herbicide-resistant plant means, you know, just more spraying of herbicides, more spraying of poisons. The second application and the second category of genetic engineering is called Bt crops. Now, Bt comes from a soil organism called Bacillus thuringiensis. In the soil, it has safeguards because it only becomes toxic in the guts of a caterpillar family of insects. The caterpillar has certain enzymes which turn this prototoxin and endotoxin into a ready-made toxin. But in the plant, the gene produces a ready-made active toxin, which now starts to affect other things. Animals grazing on Bt cotton fields in India are dying. Autopsies done show that they haven't been able to digest the biomass. Our institute has just completed a study on the soil, and we didn't even imagine impact would be as serious as it is. Since this toxin now, as I mentioned, is a broad-spectrum toxin, and it's being released from every cell of the plant at every moment, in the root zone, in the leaves, in the pollen, in the Bt cotton fields, we found a disappearance of 17% of the microorganism that digest the organic matter and turn it into humus, the bacteria that are responsible for biodegradation. 26% of the disappearance of enzymes that allow the plant to take up phosphates. Because it's not that you can put phosphates and the plant takes it up. There's mediation through all kinds of fungi and enzymes and bacteria. There's an amazing ecosystem down there in the soil. And nitrogen fixing requires soil organisms. 22% of those soil organisms have been killed in the 3 years of planting of Bt cotton in a certain area. Now, on that rate, 10 years, you've got dead soils, because soils are living because of the life in the soil. There is more life in the soil than there is more life above the soil. There's more diversity in the soil than all the diversity of plants above the soil, or all the diversity of marine ecosystems. It's the least studied, least understood biodiversity on this planet. But it's not just the soils and animals that are being killed. One of the issues that has preoccupied me a lot is the issue of farmers' suicides. We never had farmers committing suicide in our area. In fact, when they brought the Green Revolution, the writings of the American experts used to be, oh, Indian farmers are fatalists. They accept anything. You can't push them into feeling that, you know, they're lacking in something. You can't make them feel they need something additional. It's a very satisfied community. In the last 10 years, since globalization started to change our agriculture, and since industrial chemical agriculture was expanded and genetic engineering was introduced, we've had 200,000 farmer suicides in 10 years. How does globalization get linked to it? There's an agreement in WTO called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Agreement, and Monsanto, which is one of these big war chemical industries that today controls most of the seed supply of the planet. They have bought most local seed companies, in India, in America, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Europe. They have recently bought up the biggest vegetable seed company and therefore are now starting to do genetic engineering of vegetables, and we have this campaign on our wonderful eggplant, saying no to BT eggplant. Now, this agreement is many things, you know. It contains issues of software so that Microsoft gets to sell you a program and you can't borrow from your neighbor or your friend. In Peru, they actually sent IPR police into university dorms to check the computers of every student to make sure they had the purchased software and not the borrowed software, which is what makes the open source software movement so important. It also has, and this agreement is also the things about Mickey Mouse, you know? I mean, it doesn't say Mickey Mouse, but Disney was part of the influence on this agreement. They had created an intellectual property committee that wrote the agreement. And as Monsanto says on record through its representative, James Enyart, in designing this agreement, we were the patient, diagnostician, physician all in one. We defined a problem. And according to them, the problem was that farmers save seeds. In every culture, throughout human history, the ethics has been seed cannot be destroyed. You cannot eat the seed. So you have story after story in every culture of how people died of hunger, but the seed was never touched. A story from my region, how in the mountain areas, I come from the Himalayan mountains where Chipko started, that people died of hunger, but the seed bins were packed. You have to save the seed for the future. But that is now a problem for seed monopolies. If seed can be saved, grown, multiplied, shared, where do you make your money? So you create legal systems and you create technological systems so that seed cannot be saved and reproduced. The legal system is the intellectual property system, the patent system. If you have a patent on something, then nobody else can have that thing without paying you a royalty. You know, the Audio Technica made this equipment here. It's fine they made this equipment because some other industry will make that equipment and they'll pay a license if this is patented. But in the case of seed, the industry doesn't create seeds. Industry does not create life forms. The best they can do is manipulate the life form. But manipulation is not creation. Putting toxins into a plant is not creating that plant. It's polluting that plant. It's hurting that plant. And this myth of creation has led to patenting of seed. When Monsanto has a patent, then a farmer saving seed is a thief. A farmer exchanging seed with a neighbor is a thief. And so the problem they defined was seed saving, and the solution they offered was patenting. Totally illegitimate. Illegitimate on justice grounds, sustainability grounds, but also on patent grounds, because you're giving a patent to something that's not patentable. And I've been very much part of this whole, you know, in all the work I do, the movement I started called Navdanya 21 years ago, is because of these issues. That we have to have seed that is not monopolized. We have to have seed that is not genetically modified. We have to have seed that is diverse. That is a vital part of creating food and agriculture security, because the first link in the food chain is the seed. And everything else gets shaped by what the seed is like. If it's genetically modified, you get genetically modified food. If it's engineered to respond to chemicals, as in the Green Revolution, you get more chemicals in your food. You get more pesticide residues. The seed determines what food you have. It also determines who will grow the food. It determines how you will have entitlement to it. And to make that monopoly complete, there's a second agreement of WTO. That is the agriculture agreement. Now, I call the TRIPS agreement the Monsanto agreement, and I call the agriculture agreement the Cargill agreement. How many of you know Cargill? How many of you are aware that Cargill exists? Well, not all of you. They control 70% of the world food supply. Cargill officials were deputed to be the U.S. trade representatives to write this treaty and impose it on the world. And this agriculture agreement is not about agriculture. It's about destroying agriculture, it's about destroying food security, and granting Cargill, ADM, ConAgra access to every market of the world. That is how we had the food crisis of last year. Because India, for example, grows enough food for itself. But if we are forced to import, and we've been forced to import through the WTO, when we are forced to import, behind the US exports are huge subsidies. The rich countries give $400 billion subsidies. You know, you've just had a series of bailouts for banks and the automotive industry. But since chemical industrial agriculture started, there has been an every year bailout of what I would call the war industry, the industrial agriculture industry. Every year they've been bailed out on the world scale by $400 billion. Without it, it won't work. Because remember I said it needs 10 times more finance, 10 times more energy, 10 times more inputs than you get out of it. You can only sustain a negative system like that by bringing down the price. And that price is brought down through subsidies. And the subsidy structure then ends up being used to force other countries, like mine, to import. That's why I've called free trade is not free trade. WTO is not about free trade. It's about forced trade. It's about forcing you to buy what you don't need. And all this is done through the measure of opening up borders and the subsidy question. Let me come back to the cotton issue. Since Monsanto, you know, through TRIPS, Monsanto got an access to the Indian seed market. And today they are a monopoly. They have licensing arrangement with every Indian seed company. Every time you buy a BT product, you are buying a Monsanto product. The royalties are going to them. And the price difference is so huge. India is one of the areas where cotton was domesticated. And this basically means we have lots of varieties of cotton. We used to have 1,500 varieties of cotton. We had blue cotton and pink cotton and brown cotton and green cotton, and we had perennial cottons, and most of our cottons used to always grow as an intercrop. You know, you have cotton, but you have food. Over time, you know, in the last 15 years, it was first shifted to hybrids and now to BT cotton. BT cotton must be a monoculture, so it drives out the food. But it's also very vulnerable to pest attacks, even though it's supposed to be about controlling the bollworm, but it's creating new pests, and the bollworm is getting resistant. In the same 3 years while the soil was being killed, we've just done a survey of how much more pesticides farmers are using, because all of Monsanto's calculations are farmers are using no pesticides anymore. But we happen to work in these areas. So we just go door to door, ask the farmers, how much more are you using? 13 times higher levels of pesticide use today. So you take seed, which used to be 7 rupees a kilo if you bought it, and has become 17,000 rupees a kilo. Then you take a 13-fold increase in pesticide use and chemical fertilizers and irrigation systems and groundwater mining. You add it all up. Within a year, a farmer has got into a debt of 40,000, 50,000. Meantime, 25,000 farms in this country, all of which owned by agribusiness. Cotton farms are not family farms. 25,000 farms are collecting $4 billion of subsidies to reduce the price of cotton to half, then dump it on us. So a farmer is spending 10 times more on inputs, and the product is getting one-third or half the price that they used to get. And you can see this means dead end. That is why farmers are committing suicide. The combination of monopolies on seeds married to chemicals and a deceptive market based on subsidies that constantly lowers the price for farmers. And by lowering the price for farmers, doesn't allow people to make a living or have a life. One of the biggest reasons for world hunger, in my view, is the fact that the growers of food today are spending more money growing the food, borrowing, than they can ever pay back through what they have grown. The second aspect of this issue linked to the increasing control of corporations on agriculture, and even more now through globalization, which has meant industrialization spreads worldwide. When the same agribusiness sells inputs to the farmer, it's very high cost. Then it buys from the farmers at very low prices. And then it sells through trading systems the produce again at high prices. So they make money three times over. Yeah, at the input level, at the buying cheap from farmers and selling dear in the market. And the concentration has meant that the polarization is deeper between what a farmer gets and what people pay. But since the farmer is selling off everything he or she has grown to pay for the debt for the chemicals and seeds, when the farmer sells, they will sell it at one-fourth the price. And when they have to go buy the same thing, because the farmer must eat also, then they go borrow a second time over, but they can only borrow one-fourth of what they had grown. So systematically, food consumption levels are coming down. If a farmer grows rice, he'll probably sell it at 2 or 3 rupees a kilo. And then he goes to buy it, it's about 10 rupees a kilo. And because of this bondage created through costly inputs, and it is a slave system. In fact, the Punjab uprising of 1980s was the farmers declaring we are in a slave system. And that slave system means farmers are totally locked into debt. One option is leave the land, foreclosure. Second option is end your life. But a world without farmers is a world without food. And that is the real food crisis. That the farmers are being wiped out from across the world. In this country, the disappearance of farming has taken place over the last 50 years. In my country, it's taken place over the last 10 years. But the figures are so low for the United States now, 2% of people, or less than 2% on the land. You don't even have a census count anymore. There are more people in the prisons than there are on the farms. And that's partly because there's more thinking about how money can be made out of prisons than to keep farmers alive. There is another aspect of this food crisis, which is a silent crisis, and that is linked to what I said about the disease epidemic industrial food is creating. We've constantly been told industrial agriculture produces more food. I've been working with biodiversity. The movement I built in Navdani is about biodiversity. We grow lots of biodiversity. We save old seeds. We grow them out. We pack our farms. Our farm, Navdani's farm, grows 1,000 crop varieties. Our members grow 2,500 varieties. Most places of the world where women still control the farming and decide what will be grown, the results have been higher levels of productivity and higher levels of diversity. Let me just read out a few. A Nigerian home garden, women plant 57 species. Sub-Saharan Africa, which in the world's mind is an area that has no food, 120 different plants are grown alongside the cash crops, and it's the women who manage all these diversity. In Guatemala, home gardens of less than 0.1 hectare will have more than 10 trees and diverse crop species. In a single African home garden, more than 60 species of food-producing trees were counted. In Thailand, 230 food-producing species are counted. Home gardens run by women in Nigeria produce more food than the rest of the land that is being cultivated through large-scale methods of mechanization and chemical inputs. That is how food security was ensured, through diversity, which produces higher levels of output of nutrition per acre. And I think the real thing we should be measuring is not a yield of a commodity, but the nutrition of the food basket. And as long as food was in women's hands, it was about nutrition. It was about feeding the family, the community. As agriculture has become about profit-seeking, food has become a commodity. A commodity is neither nourishing anymore, because the nature has changed, like the potato, which makes furniture one day and feeds us the next day. It's being increasingly emptied of its nutritional value. Not only do you have less nutrition because you have a monoculture that has made the diversity of nutrition disappear, but you have lesser nutrition because your food itself is empty of nutrition. I have called it empty Mars. It's empty of nutrition and loaded with toxins. A UK study has shown that between 1940 to 1991, vegetable had lost on an average 24% of their magnesium, 46% of their calcium, 27% of their iron, and no less than 76% of their copper. Now, magnesium is vital to attention. It's vital to maintaining concentration. And there has been a feeding program in England where an organic chef, Oliver something, he fed organic food in the schools, and these kids who could not sit still and had such high levels of attention deficit disorder started to calm down because the organic food has all the nutrients. It's not empty food, and magnesium was being supplied. Scientists I've talked to have said that it's the lack of calcium in the food that is actually one of the contributing factors to obesity, because calcium is a gatekeeper, and it allows the body to release fat and release energy. But when you don't have adequate calcium, your gate is shut. And the body does not know how to release the fat and energy anymore. Basically, obesity is a result of totally devastating the metabolism through which the body regulates itself. This body is a miracle. It's a self-organizing miracle. With intelligence of scales we haven't even begun to understand. Every cell knows what to do. Till we bombard it with chemicals and poor thing, it becomes a cancer cell. Every organ knows what to do. And you know, one of the other things that fascinates me, I'm a physicist, but I know that everything is not physics. You know? Life is not physics. In life, you do not have conservation of matter. You have the creation of matter. In physics, you have the conservation of matter and energy. In life, you can take a seed that tiny, and before you know it, you have a giant oak tree. You can take a coconut, and you have a coconut palm. Out of a tiny seed, you can grow far more biomass than is in that seed. Now, I have heard very often people justifying the application of chemical fertilizers with the justification, oh, you're taking out so much. Therefore, you should put that much. My God, can you imagine if you had to put the amount of toxic chemicals into the soil equal in mass to what you're pulling out? We'd be drowned in chemicals. In any case, most of what plants are is carbon. And what is applied as fertilizer is nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. The carbon the plants take for free from the atmosphere and recycle it for us. And in the recycling, they offer us a solution to climate change. Because climate change is a result of three kinds of greenhouse gases. The first is carbon dioxide that comes from burning fossil fuels. Industrial agriculture is 100% based on a fossil fuel system, including the nitrogen fertilizers that begin with fossil fuels. But nitrogen fertilizers also emit another greenhouse gas, and that greenhouse gas is nitrogen oxide. It's 300 times more damaging to the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. A third greenhouse gas is methane. The combination of this industrialization of farming and long-distance transport, where societies that have been able to grow their food are now being forced to import it from long distance, has translated into a system where today we're generating 40% of the climate problem from industrial agriculture and corporate farming, including the fact that as soya bean becomes the base, you know, of cattle feed, of oil, of everything, more and more land is going under soya. All of Argentina is today under Roundup resistant soya. They spray from the air. No one can farm anything else because, as I mentioned, Roundup kills everything green. So if you want to be a vegetable gardener or an organic gardener, you can't do it anymore. It's one toxic landscape. The Amazon is being cut down for soya. We have reduced our food base from 8,500 crops to four crops that are genetically engineered and one or two other commodities, rice and wheat, which are also losing their life-giving aspect. And as more hunger is created, as more people are deprived of their access to food, hunger itself becomes the biggest market. There is, at this point, as I talk with you, a big fight going on, and it's about who will feed the malnourished. You know, people who can afford to buy food, go to Whole Foods, you go to a farmer's market, or you go to Walmart. And the more people lose jobs, the more they go to Walmart. And the argument is constantly used, cheap is good. But cheap, as I mentioned, is cheap because of the subsidies on the one hand and the monopoly buying on the other. If only one company will give you the seeds of tomato and buy back that tomato, tomato will be very cheap. If only one company will give you the seeds of cotton, and then you have monopolies in the trade in cotton, cotton will become cheaper than it cost to produce. On an average, the price of agricultural output is half of what it costs to produce. That's why it's cheap. Now, can you imagine if we had to do that with every system, where whatever you were producing, you were spending more on doing it than you were ever getting back from it? Now that there's so many hungry people, the 1 billion hungry children in the world, and 70% of India is severely malnourished, and the hunger in India grew while the economic growth grew. You know, while we were hitting 9% in terms of economic growth, more children in India were going hungry because the same processes that were leading to growth were leading to hunger. Everything that led to growth as its measure on the market, which is more trade and more commercial transaction, meant less food for children. So now you've got everyone who's made money destroying the health of people and creating malnutrition, jumping on a bandwagon and offering solutions to hunger. So you've got something called GAIN. GAIN means profit, of course. But it's also called the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. On this are Bayer, which is a toxic company, Coca-Cola, Dow AgroSciences, Dow Chemical, DuPont, ExxonMobil, in the business of feeding babies food. Yeah. General Mills, Hershey Food, Kellogg, Kraft, McDonald's, Merck, Monsanto, Nestle, Novartis, PepsiCo, Pfizer, Procter & Gamble. And they've organized themselves in what they call International Life Sciences Institute. Now, we have a huge issue right now in India about this, because we are basically saying, first of all, that malnutrition is caused by denying communities and families the right to food. You've got to give back that right through the way you grow food, through food sovereignty. And there will be no hungry children. And where there are hungry children, if they have to be fed, the best, most secure source of both knowledge as well as provisioning are the women and mothers of the community. Both because they know how to use different foods better, and they're not going to turn their kids into a source of exploitation for profits. They will bring genuine nutrition to their kids. Let me give you an example of how messy this is becoming. They have floated something called a golden rice. It hasn't seen the market yet, but it's being tried on children, being tested on children. It's a genetically engineered rice that is supposed to get rid of blindness through vitamin A. Now, the vitamin A content in this rice was 34 micrograms for every 100 grams of food. The greens that women use in home gardens, in cooking, like our curry patta, dhania, all of that, 1,400 micrograms. Yeah? 1,400 versus 34, and this is supposed to increase vitamin A availability? I have called this the monoculture of the mind. You know, you don't have the capacity to see the diversity, you declare it doesn't exist, and then you bring an inferior toxic solution and say this is the only way. But it is linked to structures of power, and those structures of power are structures of capitalist patriarchy. They're structures that basically say Capital has creativity. Nature is dead. Women don't produce. And they were getting away with that myth about the creativity of capital, that capital grows. Seeds don't grow. Gardens don't grow. Capital grows. And then they worked out derivatives and collateral debt obligations, and everything was growing till it collapsed. The growth on Wall Street was a fiction. And it is time now for us to turn to the real growth of food, the real growth of people, the real growth in an ecofeminist paradigm where people and things grow, not money, not power, not domination, not exploitation. How do we deal with these multifaceted aspects of a world food crisis? Because it is now a world crisis. Earlier it used to be pockets. It was localized. Now it's all integrated, so it becomes a ripple effect across the world. I, of course, began to find solutions by saving seeds, building Navdanya. We have 53 community seed banks in different parts of the country where farmers save seeds, can take it, just like in a bank you can go take. And we don't charge money. We just ask a farmer to either return us twice the seed or give it to two farmers more. And that's how, in the areas where we work, there is no indebtedness. There are no farmer suicides. Farmers are earning 10 times more than farmers growing chemical food or GM crops. The organic training is the second part we do. But because after you've grown all these wonderful things and we've kind of brought biodiversity back into the diet, we have a program called Forgotten Foods. And the program of Forgotten Foods is totally women-led because only women know how to cook, use, eat forgotten foods. Women above 50. And so we also run on a little school I've started. It's called the School of the Seed, the Beat with your Peat, and we offer courses at the school. When I go back home, I will go straight into a course we are running, which is called the Grandmother's University. Because, you know, we've got a choice now between letting Monsanto tell us what's good for us or letting our grandmothers tell us what's good for us. And I would rather put my trust in our grandmothers. That's what we do in India. It's the same work we have to do all over the world. We have a convergence of multiple crises. We've got the financial crisis. Suddenly, the idea of jobs based on money is disappearing as fast as the money itself is. And I noticed in my travels over that USA Today had an article that there's been a doubling of bartering. That's how economies used to run. They used to be barter economies. We were told we are primitive. You know, we shouldn't exchange things amongst neighbors. We should do one thing, sell it to someone we don't know, and then buy whatever we need. Sad thing about that kind of economy is people lose at both ends. The producers lose because they've stopped being economically self-reliant. The consumers lose because they move constantly into a downward spiral of bad food, toxic food, lethal food. Nobody is gaining out of this except Monsanto, Cargill, whose profits went up last year even as the food scarcity increased. Their profits doubled. Monsanto increased the price of corn from $200 for seed corn from $200 a bag to $300 a bag. Seed will need to be saved and distributed in this country too. Seed savers will have to become the backbone of local economies. I know the organic movement is spreading, but the last generation of the organic movement was based on the assumption that the better of people can buy a slightly more expensive product. The new generation of the organic movement will have to be based on the recognition, first and foremost, that organic will only work to the extent it's local to offer an environmental solution. Because you remember the 40% problem from industrial globalized agriculture? There's a 40% solution in local ecological agriculture. The second very important issue is, you know, my son decided to become a photographer, but all, you know, all people of his generation I knew thought the place for deliverance was the financial markets. They all made a beeline for Citibank, and which was the one that went under? Lehman Brothers and AIG, and not going to be the future. We call them the dinosaurs of the last century. And if the dinosaurs of the last century are not going to be our security, what is going to be our security? The earth. I think we have to shift radically in our understanding of sustainability, in our understanding of environmentalism. Earlier, environmentalism was something out there, you know, far away, a polar bear. Today's environmentalism will have to be rebuilding the natural capital that allows us to meet our needs on the one hand and generates livelihoods, jobs, and options for economic recovery on the other hand. It's the same actions we need for economic recovery as we do for solving the climate problem, as we do for addressing the food crisis. These are all interrelated crises. And small steps in building a local ecological food system are big steps in addressing these mega crises that we face. The wonderful thing this is doing is making food respectable again. Food was sort of an afterthought, you know, and every time I visit this country, I kind of get into a tizzy. Everyone's walking with a cup of coffee and a burger in their hand and also trying to have a phone conversation, you know. I think the dignity that food deserves is going to be increasingly important. But the dignity that food producers deserve is going to be very important. And increasingly, the knowledge we thought we could forget, the knowledge that women have of how to save seeds, how to make a local food, how to preserve something without chemicals, that's only exclusively women's knowledge, because only women knew how to do preserving before the chemical age. So it's a time to celebrate the new task of recovery, a new task of recovery in which we become co-creators with nature and co-producers as a community. This will not begin with governments will always have a time lag of about 20 years. That's my life's experience. 20 years from now, they'll wake up to it, but we can't afford to wait 20 years. So we begin the work now, and let's do it. Thank you.
You have been listening to a program by Global Voices for Justice. This talk by Dr. Vandana Shiva on sustainability and the world food crisis was given at USC on March 9, 2009.
You can find out more about the audios and videos done by Voices for Global Justice on the web at voicesforglobaljustice.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
Ninety years go by like clouds in an autumn sky, like words lost in endless conversations. In dreams we build our perfect worlds, our hearts made strong, fingers curled round stones cast from our imagination. Some stones never crumble or collide as from our dreams they're torn. With these stones I have traveled all my life, I'm still holding on. I've stood with men in fields of mud, trenches filled with piss and blood. I felt the burn of tears, perspiration. I've seen friends and brothers die, remember every crime that I committed in the name of my nation. Sometimes I wonder what it's worth, this world that I'm asleep. As all our hopes are squandered and destroyed in emptiness and greed. When I lay down in that cold ground, I don't want a flag wrapped around me. When I lay down in that cold, cold ground, I'm not a superstitious man. I've always done the best I can, and I've never had a God to light my way. But I kept my faith in fellow men, swore I would never fight again, 'cause nothing is worth the sacrifice we gave. Say we cannot forget those brave souls who fought their country's cause. It's them who must remember what was lost in their war to end all wars. When I lay down in that cold ground, I don't want their flag wrapped around me. When I lay down in that cold ground, I don't want their flag around me. When I lay down in that cold, cold ground.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Marilyn Waring on Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. You are about to hear radical critique of economic growth, today's indicator of the well-being of a society. Growth over 10% a year in China, that's considered good. Growth is down in the U.S. under the current financial crisis, and that's considered a problem. But what is growth? Growth is measured as GDP, gross domestic product, in a formula that measures all and only monetary transactions for goods and services in a given year. And Marilyn Waring, author and former member of the New Zealand Parliament, says that there is something fundamentally wrong with it. The formula was invented by John Maynard Keynes, who wrote a pamphlet during World War II entitled The British National Income and How to Pay for the War. In 1953, that Keynesian set of rules was imposed on everybody. These unquestioned rules have been used to make public policy for the last 56 years. the rules favor war over peace and ignore all activity that does not have a cash-generating capacity. Gross domestic product does not distinguish between costs and benefits, between productive and destructive activities, or between sustainable and unsustainable ones. Marilyn Waring says that GDP rules, combined with globalization, are the major cause of environmental destruction. Marilyn Waring's work and intriguing life are described in a documentary film by Terry Nash. I'm bringing back this film to support a debate on changing the current national income accounting using the GDP. Here's Marilyn Waring at a public meeting in Canada.
The more that you smoke cigarettes, or the more that you have automobile accidents, the more growth increases. Now, I'd be fairly unlikely, having smashed my car, to come home and say, darling, don't worry about it, we've just contributed to the national income of the country. I mean, I wouldn't run my household like that, and I can't think like that. I would consider that a loss, you know. I would kind of consider that a debit in my account. A cost, not a benefit. National income accounting doesn't have a debit side. As long as the activity passes through the market, it's good for growth. Let me give you a very easy example. The voyage of the Exxon Valdez. Now, the Exxon Valdez is most likely the most productive oil tanker voyage ever known on the face of the planet. Now, if it had simply loaded up its oil in Alaska and made its way down the west coast and discharged into a bunker, it would have been a moderately productive voyage in economic terms. But if you want to have fantastic growth, it's a very good idea to ram your tanker into an iceberg. Immediately there are the insurance costs and the new tanker. This is great for growth. Then there are the civil legal proceedings and the criminal legal proceedings. Immediately, of course, there's the payment for the cleanup operation. Then down the way a little bit, there are the compensations to fisher people and the compensations to the tourist industry. And of course, there is the film, the television rights, the book, the various newspaper and media exercises that go on a fantastically productive oil tanker voyage. It all added to growth. Nobody stood there and said, "Deary me, just lost an oil tanker. Better subtract that from the national income accounts."
I think most economists place a affirmative value on being incomprehensible. There's some exceptions to that. John Kenneth Galbraith, for instance, writes comprehensibly. But Marilyn, because her goal is to be understood, she understands very well that if people don't have the information, they can't act on it.
In Canada, we've signed a free trade agreement with the United States and Mexico. We hear that it's a whole question of productivity. This is going to be good for economies. This is going to boost our GNP. We look across to Europe, and the same thing is happening in Europe. The Maastricht Treaty is signed, and all these countries are saying, well, yeah, this will be great for, we'll be coming together. This will be good for our economies. How does someone like you react to that?
Well, it might change GDP figures, but you're starting from the wrong premise. I mean, all of these decisions were based on the wrong figures in the first place. For 10, 20 years, we've had these cliches, we've heard this rhetoric. You know, inside or outside discussions on free trade. You tell us things are getting better. It's perfectly obvious to us. Our air is getting worse. Our education systems are failing the poorest people. There is more poverty. There is more homelessness. There are more housing crises. And I suspect that the unease that is in Canada and in the United States, and let me tell you, in Mexico, about NAFTA has to do with the fact that doesn't matter what they say, GDP might grow up, but GDP is utterly unrelated
to the well-being of a community. It tells you nothing about levels of poverty. It tells you nothing about the distribution of poverty. It tells you nothing about primary health care, educational standards, environmental cleanliness. And folks have realized that this unidimensional economic fabrication just doesn't bear any relationship to their lives. It was 1975, was International Women's Year. I was 22 years old, and I put my name in, and sort of 6 weeks later, with some horror, recognised that I'd just been chosen the candidate for a safe seat that I couldn't lose.
Honourable members of the House of Representatives, you meet here today as members of the 38th Parliament.
Marilyn Waring's no-nonsense approach to parliamentary politics earned her respect early. In just her second term, she was appointed chairperson of the prestigious Public Expenditure Committee, a position from which she aired criticism of the effectiveness of controls on government spending, the accountability of politicians, and the dead hand of bureaucracy.
In a small country like New Zealand, this is the sole Budget Appropriations Public Accounts Committee of a parliament. So we review everything of in terms of the whole 45 government ministries and departments and trading divisions. And I can still recall, you know, interchanges when they were briefing me in my office and they would teach me something and I would say, but that's preposterous or that's crazy or that's ludicrous. And they would say to me, oh, well, yes, it is, but those are the rules. And I couldn't believe that these enormous paradoxes or pathologies that I was discovering were part of an international economic system. I thought, you know, maybe it's just we make bad policy in New Zealand. Other countries started to invite me there as their guest. And when you went there, you could ask to see their chair people of public accounts committees, their treasury boards, their budget appropriations committees. And I began to realise, hey, it's nothing to do with New Zealand. These are the rules everywhere. And I developed very early a kind of, it was a personal technique, which was in any community that I went into, I'd asked until I was introduced to a woman my age.
Well, Tendai was a 14-year-old who lived in the Lurveld in Zimbabwe. And I'm interested in the work days of young women because the International Labour Organization specifies that under 14-year-olds don't work. We're speaking of 16 to 18-hour days every day of the week. And all of the activities that they're involved in this time are unrecorded. They're called non-productive, they're called uneconomic. These women are apparently at leisure during these enormously work-filled days.
Let me tell you about my day. In the morning, before I can wash, I must walk 5 miles to fetch water. When I get back from the well, I wash things for the children, then I cook them some food for school and for the rest of the day. Then I go to gather firewood, which I use for cooking. When I come back, I tend the sheep and goats. Around 6 o'clock, the cattle arrive, then I milk the cows. I spend my evenings worrying about how to get water for the next day. And that's how I spend my day, every day, until sunset.
And the translator asks, and what do the men do? A man in the crowd answers.
A man's day is quite hard. First, he must supervise the women and children because they all come under his authority. Then he has to decide who will herd the cattle for the day, and then he worries about how to get food for the family.
It's perfectly obvious that the people who are visible to you as contributors to the economy
are the people who will be visible when you make policy. And if you're not visible as a producer in a nation's economy, then you're going to be invisible in the distribution of benefits. And wherever I was, this was the world situation for women. And at the so-called end of their working life, because they don't stop working till they die, but at that point, the government then says, well, not only have you been invisible, but now you are welfare. Now you are a dependent on the state. Now you're one of our obligations. You know, so you've got this extraordinary choice. You go from being nobody to being a problem, in spite of the fact that of all the people in the population, you just worked harder than anybody else for all those years, except you probably didn't get paid for it. It's becoming part of a global situation for me now. I mean, I'm able to make analogies between the unpaid rural women in Bangladesh or in the Philippines and the woman back in my constituency whose work is also invisible.
She too is economically inactive, and economists record her as unoccupied. Ben is a highly trained member of the US military. His regular duty is to descend to an underground facility where he waits with a colleague. When I wrote this, it was a colleague, but now, due to drug abuse in the US military, it's with two colleagues, for hours at a time, for an order to fire a nuclear missile. So skilled and effective is Ben that if his colleague were to attempt to subvert an order to fire, Ben would, if all else failed, be expected to kill him to ensure a successful missile launch.
Well, we're trained so highly in our recurring training that we take every month in simulators like this, so that if we actually had to do it, it would be an almost automatic thing. There wouldn't be time for any reflection until after we turn the keys.
Ben is in paid work. He is economically active. His work has value and contributes, as part of the nuclear machine, to the nation's growth, wealth, and productivity.
Since the mid-70s, New Zealanders had begun to demonstrate against the visit of nuclear-powered or nuclear weapons-bearing ships to New Zealand.
Well, the nuclear ships issue wasn't just a matter of not having nuclear weapons in New Zealand. It was a whole question of sovereignty. Here on the wharf in Wellington, by treaty, New Zealand was prohibited to store, possess, transport, use nuclear weapons. This seemed to me to be treated with utmost contempt by a so-called ally, the United States, who would draw ships up alongside our wharves, you know, that were nuclear-powered or that would have nuclear arms on them. And so if we were to do anything, the least and the only thing we could do was to ban them from New Zealand, from our territorial waters, from beside our walls. New Zealanders felt this very keenly. They didn't just feel it keenly as a peace issue. They felt it very strongly as an environmental issue.
There should be no nuclear weapons inside our sovereign territory.
Those were the words of an MP who wouldn't back down, and that was the conviction that led to the Prime Minister admitting he couldn't count on her vote on the nuclear issue.
Close to midnight and in high spirits, the Prime Minister with the announcement that shocks the nation, a snap election.
Well, no, six, and bring them in fast.
There's a sense of urgency about Parliament by now.
I just withdrew from the government on the nuclear legislation, and it forced an election, forced an urgent election.
Sir Robert blamed YPAR MP Marilyn Waring for not guaranteeing her support for his late-night ride to Government House and the dissolution of Parliament.
Quite frankly, I didn't agree with it. But there you are. It happened, and, you know, you've got to respect Marilyn for her dedication and her beliefs. And as I say, that democracy working. That's a prime example, isn't it? That, you know, one person like that can bring the government down.
She had the majority of people saying, well, good on you, Marilyn, for saying things you are saying, and that she had a reputation for being fearless and speaking her mind, which I think was... ordinary people appreciated that very much indeed.
The election was fought on nuclear-free New Zealand, and it was a resounding victory. 72% of New Zealanders voted for it.
Did you have any doubts when you walked across that floor? You knew that the government that was in power, the government that you were a member of, could fall.
Sure. It always amazed me that that's not what members of parliament realise they're there for. I mean, there ought to have been 86 other people sitting there thinking that. It's our job, it seemed to me. I mean, if you're elected to go represent the people, you ought to be ready at any minute, at any hour, at any day, to go on principle. It's not a job for life.
Got to stand up on high ground.
The constituency was in good hands. Catherine O'Regan had taken over my old parliamentary seat. So I had some time for intensive research, and I set off to try to unscramble the codes of global economics. I didn't really have much idea what I expected to find. It was just that this is where the search kept leading me. Everyone kept saying, well, there are a set of rules, and they're called the United Nations System of National Accounts. And if you want to read the full set, this is where you've got to come. So it was either going to be the end of the search or the beginning of a whole new one. The United Nations Statistical Commission has annual conferences. It is certainly dominated by ideologues from the United States and works very, very closely with the World Bank and the IMF. And the difficulty is, of course, that hardly anybody from various governments' treasuries, those people who actually define macroeconomic policy, come anywhere near these conferences, have any idea what the new rules are, let alone have ever read them. When massive international rules are operating in a situation where no one who is implementing them is required to read them, then you know immediately you have a massive set of propaganda operative. But it was also so offensive, so chronically malevolent. And every day or two, I'd find yet another truly horrendous paragraph that meant I had to keep going. The worst day of all was when I discovered the paragraph, subsistence production and the consumption of their own produce by non-primary producers is of little or no importance.
Well, after, I guess, about 2 months of reading through the System of National Accounts, you can start to believe you're slightly crazed or that you're not reading things properly, because the distortions between what is in the rules and what is real life that you observe is so extreme that I kept thinking I'm still missing something. And so again, I went to talk to John Kenneth Galbraith and said to me, look, for goodness sake, write it. Stop talking about this. You've known enough. You've read enough. Just write it.
Well, I'm very proud of that. I have quite a few visits, so
Not all are strong in my memory, but I certainly remember her coming to see me. We had a long talk about the role of women in the economic system. The whole tendency in economics is to take the monetary economy, the pecuniary economy, not only as the basic thing to be measured. If there isn't money involved, if there isn't a price, you don't measure it. And that leaves women's work in the household and a great deal of child care and so forth out of the national accounts. It is enormously productive work, both for human enjoyment and for the welfare of the economy and the growth of the economy, that doesn't get counted. And it was this that Marilyn was concerned with, as indeed I would like to think I have been.
The system was developed by John Maynard Keynes and Richard Stone, based on a pamphlet they wrote called, literally, The British National Income and How to Pay for the War. And this became the basis of national income accounting.
Stone was then recruited by the new United Nations organization to take the rules that he'd had in Britain and to enlarge upon them for international consumption. Of course, he didn't really. He just translated what was a system that suited the British Empire into a neo-colonial exercise for the whole world. And so by 1953, that set of rules was imposed on every country, including all the newly emergent independent countries.
It's called the United Nations System of National Accounts, and to a significant extent, it governs all our lives. All nations must conform to these rules of economic measurement, or they cannot belong to the United Nations. They cannot borrow from the World Bank or secure any loans from the International Monetary Fund. Important decisions are made with these figures, decisions which will determine whose needs are met first, decisions on how to spend your tax dollar, decisions on killing the planet, decisions on who will live or die. These measurements are highly selective. So what is included and excluded in this system? The system includes everything that goes through the marketplace. Everything which has a cash-generating capacity. In other words, the system recognizes no value other than money. Regardless of how that money is made, this means that there is no value to peace. This means that there is no value to the preservation of natural resources for future generations. This means there is no value to unpaid work, including the unpaid work of reproducing human life itself, including the unpaid work of women who feed and nurture their own families. This system cannot respond to values it refuses to recognize. This system leaves out the work of half the population of the planet, and the planet itself. It is the cause of massive poverty, illness, and death of millions of women and children, and it is encouraging environmental disaster. This is an economic system that can eventually kill us all.
Since powerful forces in banking and public policy are driving attempts to increase growth to solve the 2009 financial crisis, it is so important to listen to the critics of growth. There are many explanations why war is so profitable. Under the GDP accounting system, war is the biggest growth industry of all. When John Maynard Keynes invented the GDP formula during World War II, he explicitly designed it as a system of how to pay for the war, end quote. And some say that unlimited growth, along with globalization, has driven the wars and environmental destruction of the past 50-plus years. Here's Marilyn Waring in the soundtrack of her film, Who's Counting? Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. After addressing the issue of war, she presents her ideas for a replacement system to the GDP.
The international trade in arms is the biggest growth industry of all.
They scout aircraft for acquiring targets at day or night. It worked in Desert Storm with...
The five permanent members of the Security Council are also the five leading arms exporters in the world.
Out beyond 10 kilometers, but fast mounted sight.
Killing people, or preparing to kill them, is considered very valuable in the international economic system. Arms exports account for more than half the trade surplus of the developed economies. But the death, homelessness, injury, poverty, and starvation caused by the use of these weapons is not even registered as a deficit.
If a country develops an economic system that is based on how to pay for the war, and if the amounts of fixed capital investment that are apparent are tied up in armaments, and if that country is a major exporter of arms and its industrial fabric is dependent on them, then it would be in that country's interests to ensure that it always had a market. It is not an exaggeration to say that it is clearly in the interests of the world's leading arms exporters to make sure that there is always a war going on somewhere.
Every minute, 30 children die from want of food and inexpensive vaccines. And every minute, the world's military budget absorbs $1.3 million of the public treasury. This is war. The United States now devotes over $200 billion a year to military defense against foreign enemies. But 45% of Americans are afraid to go out alone at night within 1 mile of their homes. This is war. For every 100,000 people in the world, there are 556 soldiers, but only 85 doctors. This is war. For every soldier, the average world military expenditure is $22,000. For every school-aged child, the average public education expenditure is $380. This is war. The cost of a single new nuclear submarine equals the annual education budget of 23 developing countries with 160 million school-aged children. This is war. War is marketable. War pays, literally. War contributes to growth and development. The Philippines can be seen as a microcosm of the entire developing world. These are the hills overlooking the port city of Cebu in the southern part of the Philippines. It's a rural area which has been left vacant by an absentee landowner. A group of families have moved on to this land and built their huts and established a community here. Most of the men only get sporadic jobs, or they provide cheap labour for some of the large cash crop plantations around the country. So it's really up to the women themselves to provide for the children. The average Filipino woman has 8 children to raise and no access to abortion, family planning, or divorce. You can imagine the anxiety that a mother of 8 must feel if she doesn't know where she's going to get enough food to feed them all every day. This is the reason that women in rural areas all over the world grow food crops or raise farm animals. This sort of farming is usually called subsistence agriculture. It doesn't involve the exchange of money, but it does ensure that these children will eat. The system of national accounts says that the domestic and personal services which don't count are the cleaning, decoration, and maintenance of the dwelling occupied by the household, the cleaning, servicing, and repair of household goods, the care of the sick, infirm, or old people, the transportation of members of the household or their goods, the preparation and serving of meals, the care, training, and instruction of children. The World Bank would argue that to change the conditions of life for these people requires export growth, to make room for productive exporting enterprises. These unproductive women and their families would simply be kicked off the land. The new company could then take further advantage of the homelessness it had helped to create by getting cheap labour here. The number of homeless children in the urban squalor of developing countries is now epidemic in its proportions. The cycle of poverty begins to repeat itself very early, as the eldest girl in a family at age 8 or 9 is expected to give up school and look after her youngest siblings, while her mother uses that time to do whatever she can to keep her family alive. Older boys may be left to fend for themselves and to sleep in the streets. Jennifer and Renren are 10-year-olds. They are just 2 of the children available through this Japanese brochure, which sells men-only tourist junkets to the Philippines. Recent studies in Thailand, which also has a lucrative business in female sexual slavery, have shown that 70% of the women and girls have become infected with the HIV virus. Those who sexually exploit children are counted as doing productive work, increasing economic growth. Even if their activities are illegal, they're considered valuable enough to be in the calculations because they're income generating. Female sexual slavery is a major growth industry worldwide. And where a multi-million dollar industry in prostitution is operating, full advantage is taken of this grinding poverty. Foreign-owned companies and a small Filipino elite own 90% of the land. In a country of 58 million people, 20 million are now homeless. Thanks to multinational monocrop plantations, the Philippines is the 14th largest exporter of food in the world. And yet 80% of the children who live here can't get enough to eat. Over 1 billion people on the planet are malnourished,
In the developing countries, 50,000 people a day die from malnutrition. $17 million children in the world die each year from diseases that are related to poverty. Two-thirds of these deaths are preventable. The gross domestic product claims to measure the well-being of a country. When my friends Imelda and Loris harvest New Zealand seafood for their families, it isn't seen as economically valuable. But if they went and bought the oysters in tins at the supermarket, then that would be counted.
Before the Europeans come on, the Maoris never ever had electricity and things like that. So their food mainly depended on from the sea, was gathered from the sea. We have a custom that's called Kai Moana. Its meaning is gathering of food, mainly shellfish, from the sea. We go out when it's the tide's low and pick up seafood, mussels, oysters. The oysters take about 2 to 3 years to grow, so that's why you just take a little bit.
Yeah, we only usually take enough food for a meal, you know.
Then if you're still hungry in a couple of days, you come back and get another bucket full, and then you have them fresh all the time.
But we never sell it. The old Maoris don't sell shell food. It's not meant to be. It's meant, you know, they give it away.
You never ever sell it. You get the odd one who'll take it back to the cities to sell, but the elders usually come down hard on them and say, it's costing you nothing. And if you come and take a whole lot of food from here, then the next person that comes along to get some can't find it because you're taking it all away and selling it for money. You should leave it for food.
Well, if I'm going down to a beach to collect Kai Moana, I always behave the way that I've been taught by the local people, by the Māori people. And I find in this and in so many of the practices in Aotearoa, in New Zealand, that they make perfect sense. I mean, both perfect economic sense, perfect environmental sense, perfect ecological sense, from, you know, centuries of tradition of indigenous people. So why change it? Why behave any other way? I certainly feel in this entire journey that my constituents and then women and the ecosystem has been my teachers. Very early when I was a member of parliament, there was an application made for a prospecting license on Mount Porongia by a company called Gold Mines New Zealand. And the planning procedure was such that the mining company could show all the apparent good that was going to accrue to all of this area. We'll provide loads of jobs, we'll provide loads of support to the service infrastructures, you know, your schools will stay open, you'll get more roading, your post offices, all of those kinds of services, your electricians and plumbers and everybody else will have loads of jobs while we're involved in all of this. There'll be export earnings, it's gold we're talking about. There'll be substantial reductions in overseas funds. You know, we'll be here for years. Yeah, the usual growth development kinds of arguments. No debit side, you notice. There's never any debit side in terms of this kind of development. Nobody talking about what you're going to do with all the materials that you take out of the mountain that then begin to leach into surrounding farmland. The kind of scarring that would be happening in the bush and the forest and the mountains, the ruin of the habitat of so many species. Colin Murray was a party official in my constituency and a key member of the local farmers' organisation working against the gold mine licence.
it's a fascinating mountain because it's different every day. A little bit of cloud behind it. It was a volcano originally. It also plays a big part in our lives because it affects the weather so much. We have 90-inch rainfall here, which makes this area so good for dairying and farming generally. And that's brought about to a very, very large extent by Mount Parongia. The water around here, I have a lovely stream through the farm across the road there, and the water, the tests that the Waikato Regional Authority have done on the water, it's amongst the purest water in the country, and that's just something you can't put a value on.
Economics is a tool of people in power. I mean, economics didn't just come up from nowhere. It's a tool of those who want to exploit. It's a justification. And so as a so-called science, it doesn't allow for the introduction of values that don't find their way into a mathematical formula. It also operates in terms of language. You know, if you want to argue that mining this mountain would be devastating, you are invited to use a whole lot of words that are called soft, you know, flaky, value-laden, subjective. Economics has got it down really tight, you know, so that if you're not talking their language, if you're not talking in their jargon, you're not part of the argument, you know. So the power of economics mirrors to a great extent, you know, the political power rampant anywhere else. The economic activity that the mountain is engaged in is like 24 hours a day, never ending. It's the habitat for the pollinating species, without which none of this agriculture could survive. It's controlling the microclimate for the production that comes from everything out here. It's breathing, I mean, it's creating oxygen. None of those features can find a very easy expression in terms of cost-benefit analysis. I mean, you can't run around and say, oh, well, so much oxygen is being produced from these trees on a 24-hour basis, and the same volume of oxygen in containers in a hospital would equal, and therefore the 24-hour oxygen production of this mountain equals. Who's going to do that? This entire story so early in my political years demonstrated to me the absolute hollowness of the mathematical formula that we have to work with.
There was a tremendous uproar from the locals and plenty of meetings, well attended, and with Marilyn Waring's help we managed to block the miners, so that that's not going to take place now. It's a forest reserve now. It's all that bush-clad mountain is reserved as a forest park. This here, this farming that you can see all around you, is here forever. It's not going to go away, and we're producing something far more valuable than gold. We're producing food and clothing for people, wool and so on. And, you know, mankind can do without gold, but you can't last long without food. You know, that was our argument, and I think it's the argument. This goes on forever if we look after it. It's ours for a short time while we're here on Earth, but someone else has then got to take over. And providing we look after it, it should get better and better.
It was just a local story, you know, in my constituency. But I think as an analogy, it can be expanded to the whole planet. What are we after then? What are the alternatives? Your country, Canada, or mine, New Zealand, where there are political will, could establish qualitative environmental indicators. Indicators that told us what was happening to water quality, air quality.
the remaining stands of forest, the exploitation of mineral resources, the reproduction of fish species, the habitats of endangered species. There is no reason why tomorrow Canada or New Zealand could not establish time use surveys, because the one common denominator that all of us have, the one thing we might be said to choose to exchange, that is our own, is time. And time is a better description of the needs for intervention in people's lives than any other indicator. It shows you where the crisis points are. It shows you where the service needs are as a policymaker. In a study conducted by the Commission on the Status of Women in Canada, it was demonstrated that 2/3 of all primary health care took place in the home. If 2/3 of the budget for primary health care were directed towards those responsible for that care, imagine what would happen to that budget, and how that budget would be redistributed, and how the priorities would be turned on their head. These are the kinds of effects, in a budgetary sense, that would flow from time use surveys. Why don't policymakers or politicians or bureaucrats like this idea? Well, first of all, it's terrifying. They would have to exercise judgment. They don't have a unidimensional set of figures to which they can look and say, is growth up or down? Thereby hangs our decision. Language is a tool available to all of us. None of you, when you leave this room, should ever again say, my mother doesn't work, my wife doesn't work. That particularly relates to people who are in media or teaching positions. Push for parity. Join political parties and go to their annual conferences and year after year after year drive them crazy. Half the candidates shall be women. Half the candidates shall be women. Join this party till you get it through, then move on to the next one. I mean... Just as there is no one-way feminism, there is no one political tactic available here. There is no one political strategy. It is broad and as wide as our imaginations can take it once we have heard and seen and recognised that the emperor has no clothes. You must choose, judge, assess the strategy and tactic in your environment, in those communities that I don't have access to, just as I do it in communities you won't have access to. I mean, the only principles are that we don't stop, that we are rigorous, that we recognise that it's hard work, and lastly and not least, that we have a lot of fun along the way.
That was the former New Zealand Member of Parliament, author and goat farmer Marilyn Waring in a film about her, directed by Terry Nash. The film was released in the U.S. in 1996 and has remained a favorite for discussion groups and house parties. I checked on Marilyn Waring for this re-release of the radio version of the film and found her in the news right now for March 2009, still campaigning against the GDP accounting system, this time on behalf of the women and children who are the primary caretakers for people with AIDS in the third world and whose love and labor are not recognized and not supported. You can hear this program again by going to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. The film is distributed by Bullfrog Films in Olean, Pennsylvania, Their website is bullfrogfilms.com. For an audio copy on CD of Sex, Lies, and Global Economics, call 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or order keeps this program on the air. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get TUC Radio CDs by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Unwelcome Guests. This and all episodes are archived at the website at unwelcomeguests.org, which also contains a link where you can send me email.
Another brave man. They'll take your money and spread it out equal, just like the Bible and the prophets suggest. The men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will
listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The Supremely Political Court. As I'm recording this introduction on February 7, 2017, the name of Michael Parenti and references to his 23 books and countless lectures are flooding the internet. It appears that his writings on history, the demise of U.S. democracy, capitalism, and the rule of the 1%, fascism, patriotism, and U.S. firstism that span the decades from the late 1960s to 2014 were meant to be read and used today. Michael Parenti was born into a working-class Italian family in East Harlem, New York City. He went on to receive his Ph.D. in political science at Yale in 1962. His academic career was cut short by his dismissal. He was arrested for protesting the U.S. war in Vietnam. Parenti became an independent scholar, lecturer, and author. And he remained an activist as well. In 1995, I produced the 12-part TUC radio series, Democracy, What Went Wrong?, using archival and new recordings of Parenti's lectures. He comments on major institutions such as the military, the CIA, media, corporations, universities, police, and the Supreme Court, offering suggestions on how to regain democratic control. Today I chose to rebroadcast Michael Parenti's extraordinary history and analysis of the Supreme Court, since the court and a Trump nominee dominate the media in early 2017. Over 20 years ago, Parenti already pointed to the role of the court in concentrating wealth in the top 1%. And the way in which the Supreme Court expanded the power of corporations and laid the groundwork for what later became the Citizens United ruling of 2009. And most dangerously, given the immigration orders in the early Trump administration, how the Supreme Court began to give powers to the president in matters of foreign policy and national security that neither Congress nor the Constitution had granted. Parenti said, by judicial fiat, the president could now do whatever he wanted in the absence of specific legislative prohibitions. The example of unchallenged executive power that Parenti quoted 20 years ago in this talk, or the undeclared war in Vietnam, the unprovoked U.S. invasion of Grenada, and the U.S. invasion of Panama. Here's Michael Parenti on the supremely political court.
We're told that our Constitution is a flexible one that grows with time. It's an elastic instrument. If it is, much of the stretching has been done by the 9 persons on the Supreme Court, and the directions in which they pull are largely determined by their own ideological predilections. As Chief Justice Hughes pointed out years ago, we are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is. That's a direct quote. By its nature, the Supreme Court is something of an aristocratic branch of government. Its members are appointed rather than elected. They enjoy life tenure and are formally accountable to no one once in office, and they have the final word on constitutional matters and a great influence in their power to interpret the scope and intent of laws. As intended by the framers, the court's mandate is to act as a check on the Democratic majority and as a protector of private contract credit and property. Generally speaking, in class background and political proclivity, the justices have been more commonly identified throughout the ages with the landed interest rather than with the landless. They've identified with the slave owners rather than the slaves, the industrialists rather than the workers, the exponents of Herbert Spencer rather than of Karl Marx. Over a century ago, Justice Miller, a Lincoln appointee to the court, made note of the judiciary's class biases. Quote, "It is vain to contend with judges who have been at the bar, the advocates, for 40 years of railroad companies and all forms of associated capital. All their training, all their feelings are from the start in favor of those who need no such influence." Unquote. How a Supreme Court justice or any other federal judge decides a case has less to do with objective inquiry than with his or her ideological preference. Both conservative and liberal ideologies, of course, accept the existing economic system as an unchallengeable given. Occasionally, a president will select someone for the court whose behavior goes contrary to his expectations. But generally, presidents have been successful in matching court appointments with their own ideological preferences. President Reagan was second to nobody in this endeavor. He stocked more than half of the 744 federal judgeships with ideologically committed conservatives, mostly in their 30s and 40s, who will be handing down decisions and shaping the law of the land into the second and third decades of the next century. As compared to his predecessor, Jimmy Carter, Reagan appointed very few blacks, Latinos, or women. He also picked many more upper-class persons. 81% of his appointees had incomes of over $200,000. 23% admitted to being millionaires. That's only the ones who admitted it. Reagan's successor, George Bush, appointed an additional 195 federal judges, usually youngish right-wing conservatives, including Clarence Thomas, a 43-year-old undistinguished arch-conservative to replace the great Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas will be delivering opinions on into the third decade of the next century, maybe the fourth or fifth, too. When Bill Clinton, a Democrat, became president, he had the opportunity to appoint more than 100 vacancies and introduce some ideological diversity in the courts. As of today, he's filled about 160 of these vacancies, most without a liberal orientation, most of them kind of nondescript in their politics, if they have any politics at all. His two Supreme Court appointees had voted more often with the conservatives than the liberals on economic issues. It is said that the devil himself can quote the Bible for his own purposes. The Constitution is not unlike the Bible in this respect. Over the generations, the Supreme Court justices have really shown a really infernal agility in finding constitutional justifications for the continuations of almost every inequity and iniquity, be it slavery or segregation, child labor or the 16-hour workday, state sedition laws or assaults on the First Amendment. Under the state sedition laws, for instance, people went to jail for 20, 30 years because they said things that officials didn't like. In its early days under Chief Justice John Marshall, the court emerged as a guardian of property, declaring that a corporation was to be considered a person entitled to all the rights accorded persons under the Constitution. Much of the debate around the Supreme Court today centers on whether, one, the court should act politically and ideologically by exercising a liberal judicial activism, vigorously supporting individual rights and needs, or B, should it employ a conservative judicial restraint by deferring to the other two branches and cleaving close to the traditional intent of the Constitution? In practice, conservative justices are just as ideologically activist as liberal ones, if not more so. Only during a relatively few periods, most notably in the 1960s, did the High Court become an active supporter of individual rights and economic reform on behalf of the poor. Through most of its history, the court has engaged in a conservative judicial activism in defense of wealthy and propertied interests. When the federal government wanted to establish national banks or give away half the country to private speculators or subsidize industries or set up commissions to fix prices and interest rates for manufacturers and banks or send Marines to secure corporate investments in Central America or imprison people who spoke out against war and capitalism or deport immigrant radicals without a trial or use the United States Army to shoot workers, Indians, and to use them to break strikes— when the government wanted to do that, the Supreme Court inventively found constitutional pegs that made such actions acceptable. When the federal or state governments sought to limit workday hours, set minimum wage or occupational safety standards, ensure the safety of consumer products, guarantee the right of collective bargaining, or in other ways offer protections against the powers of business, then the court historically ruled that ours was a limited form of government that could not tamper with property rights and the free market by depriving owner and worker of substantive due process and freedom of contract, concepts that were elevated to supreme status even though the limitations claimed on their behalf exist nowhere in the Constitution. In fact, those phrases themselves don't. When Congress outlawed child labor, the court's conservative activist majority found it to be an unconstitutional usurpation of the reserve powers of the states under the 10th Amendment. But when the states themselves passed social welfare legislation, the courts found it in violation of the 14th Amendment of the Supreme Court. Thus, the justices used the 10th Amendment to stop federal reform initiated under the 14th Amendment, and they used the 14th Amendment to stop state reforms initiated under the 10th Amendment. You can't get any more activist than that. The 14th Amendment, adopted in 1868, supposedly to establish full citizenship for blacks and freed slaves, says that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Once again, the court decided that person in the 14th Amendment included corporations, and that the 14th Amendment was intended to protect big business conglomerations. They also decided that it wasn't to apply to black people in the case of segregation. They also decided that it didn't apply to women. For some reason, women were not persons. A test case reached the Supreme Court in 1875. The justices unanimously decided that women were citizens, but citizenship did not necessarily confer the right of suffrage when women tried to get the vote under the 14th Amendment. So the court had made up its mind that privileges and immunities of citizens, due process, and equal protection of the laws applied to persons, such persons as business corporations, but not to women and persons of African descent.
You're listening to rebroadcast of a talk on the Supreme Court by the political analyst, lecturer, and author of 23 books, Michael Parenti, from a 12-part series entitled Democracy, What Went Wrong, produced in 1995.
Well into the New Deal era, the Supreme Court was the activist bastion of laissez-faire capitalism. It struck down all sorts of reform legislation. From 1937 onward, under the pressure from the public and the White House, and with the switch of one conservative justice to the side of the liberals, the Supreme Court finally began to accept the constitutionality of popular New Deal legislation. While traditionally the court has opposed restrictions on capitalist economic power, it has supported restrictions on the civil liberties of persons who agitated against that power. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Yet ever since the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, Congress and the state legislatures have passed numerous laws to penalize the expression of politically heretical ideas as subversive or seditious. During the First World War, almost 2,000 prosecutions were carried out, mostly against anti-capitalists who expressed opposition to the war, including the U.S. socialist leader Eugene Victor Debs, who was in jail at the time he was running for president of the United States. The High Court's attitude toward the First Amendment was best expressed by Oliver Wendell Holmes in the famous case of Schenck versus U.S. in 1919. Schenck was charged with attempting to cause insubordination among U.S. military forces, obstructing recruitment. Actually, all he did was distribute a leaflet that urged repeal of the draft and condemned the war as a wrong perpetrated by Wall Street. Well, Holmes reasoned that such speech is protected by the First Amendment in ordinary times. But when a nation is at war, statements like Schenck's creates a clear and present danger of bringing about evils that Congress has a right to prevent, Holmes argued. Holmes was using the same old argument paraded by every ruler who has sought to abrogate a people's freedom. Namely, these are not normal times. There is a grave danger within or just outside our gates. National security necessitates a suspension of democratic rights. But you see, the First Amendment was designed to protect the very heretical views that we might find offensive and dangerous. Safely orthodox ideas rarely need constitutional protection. There are those who argue that revolutionaries and other radicals violate the democratic rules of the game and should be denied their freedom. There are several rejoinders that could be made to this point. First, as a point of historical fact, the threat of revolution in the United States has never been as real or harmful or dangerous to our liberties as the measures taken to supposedly protect us from revolutionary ideas. History repeatedly demonstrates the expansive quality of repression. In the name of national security, revolutionary advocacy is suppressed. Then inciting words, then unpopular doctrines, then irresponsible news reports, then any kind of criticism that those in power find intolerable. Americans were never given their freedoms. They had to organize, agitate, and struggle fiercely for whatever rights they've won. As with our bodily health, so with the health of our body politic. We best preserve our faculties and liberties against decay by vigorously exercising them. Second, the suppression is conducted by political elites who, in protecting us from harmful thoughts, are in effect making up our minds for us by depriving us of the opportunity of hearing and debating ideas with revolutionary advocates. An exchange is forbidden because the advocate has been silenced, and which in effect silences us too. Third, it is not true that anti-capitalists are dedicated to the destruction of freedom. Much of the ferment in United States history, instigated by socialists, anarchists, and communists, actually augmented our democratic rights. The working class agitations of the early 19th century widened the areas of dissent and helped extend the franchise to propertyless working people. The organized demonstrations against repressive local ordinances in the early 20th century by revolutionary-minded industrial workers of the world, known as the Wobblies, the Wobbly free speech fights, that fortified the First Amendment against attacks by the guardians of wealth. It made people able to go into small towns and talk and disseminate dissident ideas. The role that communists played in struggling for social reforms, peace, and civil rights strengthened rather than undermined democratic forces. The anti-war protests against the Vietnam War challenged an immoral, illegal military action and tried to broaden the spectrum of critical opinion and information regarding U.S. foreign policy. It also inadvertently led to the enfranchisement of 18-year-olds. Fourth, on this question of whether we should allow freedom for revolutionaries or we should suppress these radicals, progressive critics would argue that instead of worrying about some future menace, we should realize that freedom is in short supply in the present society. The construction of new socioeconomic alternatives would bring an increase in freedom, including freedom from poverty and hunger, freedom to share in the making of decisions that govern one's work and community, freedom to experiment with new forms of production and ownership. Admittedly, some freedoms enjoyed today would be lost in a revolutionary society, such as the freedom to exploit other people and get rich from their labor, the freedom to squander natural resources and treat the environment as a septic tank, the freedom to monopolize information and exercise unaccountable power. Those kinds of freedoms I could live without. In many countries, social revolutionary movements brought a net increase in the freedom of individuals, revolutionaries argue. They did it by advancing the conditions necessary for health and human life, by providing jobs for the unemployed and education for the illiterate, by using economic resources for social development rather than corporate profit, and by overthrowing reactionary semi-feudal regimes, ending foreign exploitation, and involving large sectors of the populace in the task of economic reconstruction. Revolutions may extend a number of real freedoms without destroying those that never existed for the people in these countries. The argument can be debated, but not if it is suppressed. In any case, the real danger to freedom in the United States is from the undemocratic control exercised by those in government, the media, academia, business, and other institutions that would insulate us from unacceptable viewpoints. No idea is as dangerous as the force that would seek to repress it. Packed with Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Bush appointees, the Supreme Court has taken a decidedly rightward turn on a variety of crucial issues over the last two decades. For instance, in decisions involving disputes between workers and owners, the courts almost always have sided with the owners, weakening labor's ability to organize and bargain collectively. The conservative court ruled that workers do not have the right to strike over safety issues if their contract provides a grievance procedure. This decision denied coal miners the right to walk off the job in the face of serious and immediate safety violations that management refused to remedy. The court decided that employers can, in effect, penalize workers for unionizing by closing down operations and denying them jobs. Companies can now unilaterally terminate a labor contract and drastically cut employees' wages by filing for reorganization under the bankruptcy law. Unions have been denied the right to prevent members from quitting the union and crossing picket lines during a strike or when a strike seemed imminent. And one could go on citing other examples. Despite a federal law limiting water subsidies to farms of 160 acres or less and to farmers who live on or near the land, the court held that large commercial farms, including ones owned by Southern Pacific and Standard Oil, were entitled to subsidies. In seeming violation of the Clean Air Act, the court said industries could expand in regions with the dirtiest air, even if it results in worsening pollution. California's Proposition 13 limited tax increases on property bought before 1975 so that persons with newly purchased homes carry tax burdens almost 400% heavier than longtime owners, including big corporate owners. The Supreme Court decided that the existence of a privileged class of property holders did not violate equal protection under the law. Some other areas where conservative judicial activism has been at work. The court has been very protective of executive power. The executive is the home of the CIA, the Pentagon, and other national security agencies that are instrumental in maintaining the domestic and global status quo. It is the branch most closely integrated with the military-industrial complex. Not surprisingly, the conservative-dominated court has repeatedly affirmed the authority of the executive over the legislature and over individual rights. The court ruled that the State Department could deny a passport to a former CIA employee who had written books exposing illegal CIA covert operations. Neither Congress nor the Constitution granted this power to the executive, but the bench declared that in matters of foreign policy and national security, the absence of an empowering law is not to be taken as a sign of congressional disapproval. In other words, by judicial fiat, the president now could do whatever he wanted in the absence of specific legislative prohibition, which is it's quite different from saying the president can do what he's allowed to do under the laws and Constitution. Now he can do anything he wants, it seems. As part of a continuing pattern of deferring to presidential power in military and foreign affairs, the federal courts refused to hear cases challenging the president on such things as the undeclared war in Vietnam, the unprovoked U.S. invasion of Grenada, the imposition of internationally illegal embargoes on Nicaragua, the U.S. invasion of Panama, and the deportation of Haitians, Guatemalan, and Salvadoran refugees. The courts decided that states could not prohibit corporations from independently spending unlimited amounts of their funds to influence the outcome of public referenda. The attempt by states to put a cap on corporate spending in elections and initiatives and referenda is overruled by the court. And any limitations on other elections, because campaign expenditures are, in the words of the court, a part of speech. And the Constitution guarantees freedom of speech to business firms and very rich individuals. Thus, the poor candidate and the rich candidate can both freely compete. Both have freedom of speech, one in a whisper and the other in a roar. Like the courts of earlier times, the activist court has played federal power against state power and vice versa to defend corporate class interests. Thus, it limited the federal government's ability to protect work conditions of employees, claiming an infringement of states' rights under the 10th Amendment. Then it restricted the ability of states to limit businesses' spending power in referenda, claiming federal prerogatives under the First Amendment. In such cases, one hears little complaint from conservatives about the court's activist usurpation of policymaking powers. A consistent double standard prevails. Judicial activism that strengthens authoritarian statism and big corporate business interests is acceptable. Judicial activism that supports democratic working class rights and socioeconomic equality invites attack. One way to trim judicial adventurism is to end life tenure for federal judges, including the justices who sit on the Supreme Court. It would take a constitutional amendment, but it would be worth it. Today, only 3 states provide life tenure for state judges. The other 47 set terms limits, ranging from 4 to 12 years. Life tenure was supposed to shield the federal judge from outside influences and place the federal courts above partisan politics. Experience shows that judges are as political and ideological as anyone else. Their independence leaves them unchecked by anything but their own sense of propriety. A 7-year or 10-year term limit would still give the jurist significant independence, but would not allow him or her to remain unaccountable for life. Judges who exhibit a hostile view toward constitutional rights could be replaced. No ideological partisan group could pack the courts for decades ahead. There would be more turnover and a greater possibility for more responsiveness to popular needs. And that's the way it should be. The people are not here to serve the courts. The courts should be serving the people.
That was Michael Parenti on the Supremely Political Court, a rebroadcast of his lecture on the occasion of the Trump administration's appeal to the federal court system in the U.S. Federal courts had challenged the Trump executive order issued on January 27, affecting citizens from seven Muslim-majority countries, travelers, and refugees. The Supremely Political Court is part of the series Democracy, What Went Wrong? How the CIA, media, corporations, universities, police, and the Supreme Court are threatening democracy, and what might be done to meet the challenge. The original series was produced by TUC Radio in 1995. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Words, what they mean to the speaker and what they mean to the listener, is the bedrock of human communication and cultural understanding. Susanna Jansen, a teacher and dedicated advocate of learning foreign languages at any age, is the author of Word Struck, The Fun and Fascination of Language, and she's our guest in this edition of Radio Curious. In Wordstruck, Jansen explores the multiple aspects of the meaning of words, how they translate from one language to another, from one person to another, and she describes curious experiences in her worldwide travels. She's particularly interested in the benefits of learning two or more languages and how doing so affects brain development, especially in early childhood. When Susanna Jansen visited the studios of Radio Curious on February 5th, 2017, we began when I asked her to describe the benefits of being bilingual.
It is still fairly controversial, but it seems to be proven now that bilingual people, and this starts from birth, probably starts before birth, actually. It probably starts in the womb, exposure to sounds in the womb. But infants are seen to have increased ability in areas like problem solving, interpersonal relations, concentration, and memory.
And if they're bilingual.
If they're being exposed to other languages.
And thus having the opportunity
to become bilingual. But they're measuring this in infants who are exposed to a second language in the home, being exposed to two languages in the home. Whether or not they go on to become bilingual or not isn't part of that particular study. And then, of course, they're studying people at all ages, and particularly people as they go through their life with bilingual capabilities. They're still noticing these same enhanced abilities, particularly with focus, memory, what's called executive functioning, you know, the problem-solving skills. And also, there has been a very interesting study that started in about 2010 and continued on over several years that indicates that bilingual people have a buffer against Alzheimer's of 4 to 5 years. So I don't know how they measure, is this person going to or not going to get Alzheimer's? But the studies show that the bilingual person has a 4 to 5 year buffer against getting Alzheimer's. And if they do get Alzheimer's, it progresses more slowly than it does in a non-bilingual person. I think that the advantages apply under any circumstances, even if a person starts to learn language late in life. But obviously, it's always true, the sooner the better. But that might be right now, you know, for someone who hasn't done it in their earlier years.
In an article that you wrote in anticipation of Valentine's Day, you mentioned that some languages have more compelling phrases of endearment than other languages. And that when people speak a different language, there's a personality change. Can you talk about that, how that balances among a person who speaks a language that would have phrases of endearment and also speaks a language that doesn't?
Wow, that's such an interesting question. The personality thing, this has been studied and it's been written about widely. I go more by what I observed in my classroom with students studying Spanish with me and also with my own experience. One time in a conference, I was telling a story. I told the story first in English and then I told the story in Spanish. And the person I was working with in this activity said to me, "You're an entirely different person in Spanish." And it had never occurred to me. And at that point, I started to really think about it, look at it, and also look into it. What I find is that in my second language, for me personally, I can say things that I might not have such an easy time expressing in my native language. I can say things more freely, particularly when it comes to terms of endearment. It's not that they don't mean as much to me in my second language, but I just feel like I have more freedom. I have fewer social restrictions on what I say.
Can you give some examples of what that freedom allows you, or the fewer social restrictions permit you to say?
It's hard for me to give advice to someone or to maybe correct them on something, particularly in a social situation. I don't mean in a classroom situation. But when I'm speaking Spanish, I have no problem doing that. I have no problem saying to someone in Spanish, "Gee, you know, it really would be better if you did this." Or someone is perhaps doing a job for me and I say, "Well, now this needs to happen." I can be more direct, but at the same time, I find that in my second language, I can also be, I think, often more heartfelt.
Does that apply when you're talking to a native speaker in that person's country?
As well, yes.
On both levels?
Mm-hmm. As well as speaking to someone who is, their second language is Spanish also.
Heartfelt, what do you mean?
I mean fewer social filters. I can just come more from the heart. I'm not thinking so much about what I'm saying as much as I'm just saying it. It's very difficult for me to explain because it happens at a level that is almost deeper than an analysis for me. So I think it probably would be interesting for me to do more research online about how this plays out with people who are actually being studied for different personality manifestations.
Looking at your book, Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language, you talk about words that exist in other languages that don't exist in English.
Well, the reverse is true as well. There are words in English that don't exist in other languages or in many other languages, and maybe we can touch on those a little bit later. But some of them are legendary, like this German word, Schadenfreude, which means taking joy in another's misfortune. This one is particularly interesting because I think that that's a universal experience or a universal manifestation, and yet the word doesn't exist in the English language. It doesn't exist in many languages, but it certainly is something that we engage in.
Why do you say it's something that's common to the human species?
From my experience in our culture, and for, let's say from in Western cultures, we are very prone to say to ourselves, "Oh, I'm so glad that's him that got the ticket and not me. He got pulled over by the cop and I didn't," or "She had the fender bender and I didn't," or or oh, the teacher came down on that student and not on me, or oh, the tree fell on the neighbor's roof and not on mine. It just seems to be our bent to do so.
Perhaps it's relief that the misfortune didn't happen to the speaker and saw it fall elsewhere.
Yes, it's not so much that we're saying, oh, he deserved it. But it's like it's relief that it didn't happen to me. It happened to someone else.
So staying with the concept of words in other languages that don't exist in English.
There are many more. I did also a second article about the ones, just the ones in Spanish. But I also came across some very interesting ones in languages that I don't know. And I verified them with some of my friends that do speak those languages. A word that's gotten to be very popular now, it's a Japanese term, wabi-sabi. It is celebration of what is impermanent and imperfect as a thing of beauty. And this has become very popular now. There's a B&B back in the New England state somewhere. And there are restaurants with the name of wabi-sabi, which perhaps they're serving up incomplete dishes of imperfect food. I don't really know. But this has become a very popular term from the Japanese language because we don't have it in our English language. So we've actually taken the term out of Japanese, wabi-sabi. Another one that's very, very popular these days is the Danish term hygge, hygge. And it's spelled H-Y-G-G-E, hygge.
And what does it mean?
It means cozy in our language does not quite convey it, not completely. It means just the warm, lovely feeling of being with friends next to the fire with a delicious hot drink in hand, listening to wonderful music. It's that kind of feeling. It's like I had to say all those phrases just to get it out, to really try to embody it. We know it when we feel it, but we don't have that word like the Danish word hygge that really encompasses it all.
Susanna Jansen, Spanish is a language that you know well and have taught many years. Can you give us some examples of what we're discussing in Spanish versus English?
One example that I love is the word sobremesa, because it's simply one word that describes fully the experience of sitting at the table after the meal has ended to just be with the people that you've dined with, to just have conversation with them. And look how many words it took me to describe that. Sobremesa. That's such a beautiful word.
A conversation sobremesa.
You'd have estamos aquí de sobremesa. We're here after the meal, just conversing with each other, enjoying each other's company.
Susanna Jansen, as we've spoken, there are words in other languages that we don't have in our English parlance. But are there words in English that don't exist in other languages that you could discuss for us?
Well, of course, there are all the technology words that come out of America mostly, so there's no translation for those. I mean, like a mouse, you can translate it as the word mouse, but that wouldn't be very sensible. But I found words, especially when I'm teaching Spanish and using Spanish, in the Romance languages, there's no word for shallow. For example, and that would be shallow as a depth of water or shallow as a person. There simply is no word. The only way to say it is less deep. That I find is very interesting. Another word that doesn't seem to exist in Romance languages is the verb to afford. Like, I can't afford to buy that car. The only way I can say that is my money won't reach that far. I don't have the funds to do that. There's no verb to afford. And then there's things like babysitter, dog catcher, storage unit, that it's a concept that doesn't exist in other languages. If we think about, for example, in Mexico, in Latin America, in China, people don't call up a babysitter to take care of their kids. It's the grandmother that comes over, it's the mother-in-law that comes over. And I just personally find these really fascinating because I will see that there's words that I look up over and over again, like helpful, and I can never find an adequate Spanish translation for the word helpful.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Susanna Jansen, the author of Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Susanna, the current situation in our country with President Trump, being who he is, choosing the words and the terms that he uses, are more difficult than that of his predecessors to translate into other languages. Can you share with us your thoughts?
I have given it some consideration because I've done quite a bit of translation in my day. Not something I want to continue doing, though. It's so, so difficult. But I read an interesting article about the problem of translating what President Trump says. And it was based on an article that was written by a well-known translator, a French woman. And what she has said is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to adequately translate Trump. In order to translate a person, you really have to kind of be able to get inside their head. She said it was very easy to get inside President Obama's head because his thinking was very logical, and he also had quite an elegant way of expressing himself. And in the case of Trump, what she points out is that his thoughts do jump from one to another, so often there's a disconnectedness about them. And he invents words, he uses slang, he is almost impossible to translate in a way that the French people or people in another country will really be able to understand what he's saying. It's very, very colloquial speech. I would say, from an ex-translator's point of view, impossible to translate.
Because the expressions don't exist in other cultural forms of language.
Yes, that as well. And because of the disconnectedness of the ideas. And she also said at one point in her article that what she writes as a translator also reflects upon her. And so she's caught between trying to reproduce his words very faithfully and trying to make sense out of them for, in her case, the French people.
Susanna, you mention in your writings the language of compassion, and I'm curious as to how that can become a focus of when somebody speaks to another individually or a group.
When I wrote the article about the terms of endearment, I did, of course, focus on all of these wonderful terms like the French, my little cabbage, and the Italian, my little microbe, because they're so fun and they're so cute. But my overall point was that it doesn't really matter what little animal you call your loved one or your child. It's about the language of compassion. It's about speaking from the heart, and it's about having conversation that offers an opening for another person to express themselves and for the two of you to get to know each other better. We think about this a lot these days as we look at text messaging, and we look at Twitter and Instagram and all these instantaneous forms of communication, which certainly seem to be the way of communicating in this early part of the 21st century. And those of us who aren't native to that technology, to these technologies, in fact, we are naive about them. And we kind of wonder, are we losing some of that compassion in the technological movement of writing a LOL for laugh out loud instead of...
If you're laughing out loud, as you just did, I can see the expression on your face.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's LOL, that describes an expression which creates an image in the mind of the reader of LOL.
As does the emoji as well. You know, the little smiley face or whatever it is. And last year, when I was writing about the words of the year, one of the big dictionary companies chose an emoji as the word of the year. And an emoji, of course, is not, or an emoticon, whatever, you know, one of the two terms you want to call it. It's not actually a word. It's a small circle with a couple of slits for eyes, and in this case, big tears coming out the corners of the eyes, and this was so joyful that I'm crying, or something like that. And I said, kind of in a comical way in the article, that maybe it was time to invent a new verb. Maybe now we need the verb to emojiate, not just to emote, but to emojiate, because we've got these little things that tell us how we're feeling.
How would you define that?
to emojiate, to not actually feel the emotion, but just to tack onto an email a little circular face that shows how I'm feeling.
Can somebody else's drawing of an array of emotions include the one that you actually may be feeling?
I don't think so. I don't even think it could include the one they were feeling. I mean, I put smiley faces on my emails now and then because it's kind of a fun, convenient thing to do. I want to say, yeah, I'm happy about this. But now there's this whole box you can choose from of emojis, and I guess I would rather describe my emotions or tell a person I'm sad or, gee, I'm so happy that this happened, rather than just tack a picture on there.
Let's talk about language police. Mm-hmm. Language police in our country limits us from speaking on this program George Carlin's seven words that deal with bodily functions and sexual activity. But language police control the morphing of language. For instance, I hear many times when I say thank you to someone, the response is no problem. Makes me wonder if me having engaged with them was a problem.
Mm-hmm. I think people in our generation do think that. We start to wonder that. And interestingly enough, there is no official language police in this country, but there's very unofficial things going on, definitely, with dictionary companies and so forth. I feel the same way. I mean, when I hear no problem, I feel like there is a problem. And I have had that conversation with a number of waiters in restaurants. After they serve me a meal and I say thank you and they say no problem, I kind of feel kind of like I have to bring it up and have a little chat with them about it. Not to say don't use it, but just to ask why they do. Why can't your welcome suffice any longer? It seems like it doesn't.
What are the answers that you receive?
Well, they just say, well, that's what I say. Or that's just the way it is. Or that's my way of saying you're welcome. Or we all say that, or something along those lines. And, of course, what will happen, and probably the worst thing that can happen with that, is then that will go to other countries next, as most of our stuff does. Most of our stuff in language and film and art gets absorbed into other countries. And many other countries actually do have a real, live language police. Spain has the Royal Academy of Language, La Real Academia. Not only the one in Spain, but every one of the 21 Spanish-speaking countries has a branch of that Royal Academy. And this organization of mainly very elderly men of letters, a couple of women in there now, they determine what can and cannot be used in the language, and of course what can and will not end up in dictionaries. And right now they have quite a campaign going on television with commercials to try to get people in advertising to stop using English words, which are used so ubiquitously because of the somehow conviction that English words are more attractive, that they're sexier, English words are more effective in advertising, people will respond and buy. So the Spanish government is really coming on strong. The French government is coming on very, very strong against the incursion of English words into the French language. Some words have been simply outlawed in any kind of official documents and even in some of the newspaper articles. Words like email, even, and words like texting, and words like the tech words that they just don't accept as being part of the language. The tech words are the hardest ones to translate, so of course they get absorbed into other languages, but the French insist that, and right or wrong, I'm not saying one way or the other, the French insist that these have to be translated. A word has to be created in French. And one more example, the Italians, on the other hand, they have a language police, but they're only recommending that people opt for Italian over English words when they're speaking, when they're writing. And it's impossible, because if I read an article, like a business article in Italian, I would say fully between an eighth and a quarter of the words are in English. They just use the English words like marketing, manager.
You mentioned an English word may be sexier than a word in French or Spanish.
In this case. Mm-hmm.
What would be an example?
I'll give you the example with the television campaign that the Royal Academy has used. It is an advertisement of a beautiful woman. She's holding a rose to her cheek, and it's a perfume ad. And it goes on to say in Spanish, a new fragrance that opens up new doors, that makes you the woman that you are destined to be. Swine, the fragrance of your dreams. And then, after it plays out, with a man comes and he embraces her. And then it says, swine, the fragrance of your dreams. It means pig, but it sounds so beautiful in English, and it smells so terrible. And then the couple, they look at each other, you know, their brows furrow. It's really quite effective, and in a cheesy kind of way. I think it's really very effective. I'm wondering what the response has been in Spain. But that's an example, you know, of naming a perfume, of naming a garment, of naming a toaster an English name, because it's just perceived to be more valuable.
Well, Susanna Jansen, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I have questions about you.
Well, sure.
Can we begin with a eureka or an aha moment that gave you new insight into your pending life or brought you into new territory?
Oh, well, if it's new territory, absolutely. And it turned into this book, and I don't say this as a plug for the book, but when I retired 5 years ago, I wasn't twiddling my thumbs, but I thought, gosh, I've got this whole pile of scribbled notes. Am I ever going to do anything with this? And I had kind of an aha moment when I started seeing that our local newspaper actually had a few columnists. And I really thought, in a flash, I thought, well, why not me? And if not now, when am I going to die with that pile of notes on my desk? And so I started to write.
And what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Oh, and it is so precious. Well, I will definitely keep on writing, and I do think I have two more books in me, at least two more books in me.
Can you share any thoughts of what they may be?
Well, one for sure is going to be a book for intermediate and advanced students of Spanish. It's not going to be a textbook. It's going to be a book to ferret out the things that we as English speakers fall into as pitfalls when we're speaking Spanish because of our own language. So we're patterning Spanish after our own language and making the same mistakes over and over again. And I just think that this would be like a guidebook, you know, it would be a handbook for students.
Would that application not fit anybody learning a second language that they did not learn originally as a very young person?
It would only fit Spanish learners because the same thing would happen. If I'm learning Japanese, I will unconsciously be applying my English patterns to Japanese.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, but I wouldn't be able to write that book. The only one I can really write at this point in my life is the one for Spanish speakers.
Because of your personal experience with Spanish.
Right. But I would love to see that book written for all languages, English speakers learning any language.
Well, pending the writing of that book, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I'm finishing up now a book that I am just loving. And it's written by Phil Cousineau, and it's called A Book of Roads. It is, of course, nonfiction. I think the subtitle is Travels from Michigan to Marrakech. And I love his writing. I love reading about travel. It's very inspiring to me. I only let myself read one short chapter a night so that I can make it last as long as I can.
Well, Susanna Jansen, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry. It's been lovely.
Susanna Jansen is a writer, public speaker, and teacher dedicated to changing the linguistic culture of America by advocating the learning of foreign languages. Based in Ukiah, California, she's a foreign language educator as well as an author, speaker, and newspaper columnist on all topics related to words, language, and culture. The book Susanna Jansen recommends is A Book of Roads, Travel Stories from Michigan to Marrakech by Phil Cousineau. This program was recorded on February 5th, 2017. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website. They're free for anyone to enjoy, download, and broadcast as you wish. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters about our programming and look forward to hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The snail mail is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. And the phone is 707-462-6541. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.